This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
The only way we can get these bad guys is to be worse than them, to be more devious. And that's how crime and law enforcement become indistinguishable. And the tactics that are used in crime and law enforcement are exactly the same, except that one group wears the mantle of legitimacy.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Douglas Valentine. Today's show, how the CIA corrupts the system. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, about the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology with Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. Today we discuss his latest book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Douglas Valentine, welcome again.
Thank you for having me on your show.
In your new book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, you've written that the collusion between crime and law enforcement is the glue that holds the system together. You say that this is the case for small towns all the way up to the federal government. How does this system of collusion between crime and law enforcement operate? And why is this the case? You asked the question, is having people who are in actuality war criminals in positions of legislative and executive authority in America an expression of a free society? What are some examples of war criminals in positions of authority in America? For example, Major General Bruce Lawler. You wrote a chapter on him. Who is he?
Well, when I was doing my research in my book, The Phoenix Program, I met a bunch of CIA officers, and they told me what they did. And Bruce Lawler was one of them. And he was a guy that he was going to college in Washington, D.C., and he got recruited into the CIA. And this was during the Vietnam War. And he was sent for training. He learned how to be both an agent handler, which is a specific job description in the CIA. There's agent handlers, but he also learned how to be a paramilitary officer, which are people that shoot guns and blow things up, and organize paramilitary units in foreign countries. And then around 1970, he was sent over, 71, he was sent over to Vietnam to work for more senior CIA officers doing these things. One of his jobs as a liaison officer was working with what was called the Special Branch of the South Vietnamese Police. They are sort of comparable to our FBI, the Special Branch of the Police. They were involved in trying to penetrate the insurgency at the highest levels. The Viet Cong insurgency had a political apparatus. You could think of them as the Democrats and the Americans and their allies as the Republicans, and the CIA and its allies and the Special Police and the South Vietnamese Army and its politicians were like Republicans, and they could not tolerate anybody who was a communist. They were after trying to find all the Democrats, all the communists in South Vietnam, and they would penetrate that organization through informants and also secret agents who would become part of it. They weren't really all that interested necessarily in arresting these people, but they were interested in being able to manipulate them to be able to say, well, we know where your family lives. If you're not good, we'll go bump off your family. So because in Vietnam, for example, all the communists knew who the special policemen were and where their families were. So you couldn't go around bumping off each other's families, or you'd have like a, you know, like with the mafia, there was, you know, you don't kill another man's wife and kids, you know, you just keep it with yourself. So that was sort of like a rule. Anyway, Lawler found himself as a very young man, maybe 24, 25 years old, in a very important position. He was a liaison to a special police officer, and that special police officer ran an interrogation center where people who were suspected of having ties to the communists were brought for interrogation. And his job was to be there and to watch what would happen and report on it back to his bosses. And when I was talking with Lawler, he was very upset about the things he saw and about how his bosses behaved. We were now, it's now into 1972, 73. There's been a ceasefire signed, and supposedly the war has stopped, and yet these kind of very, devious and deadly kind of assassinations and interrogations and torture were still going on, and they weren't supposed to be going on anymore. And Lawler was very upset. One day he walked into this interrogation center, and there was a woman laid out on a table, and she'd been murdered and raped. And he saw them. You know, the special policeman had murdered this woman, and he was just stunned. He didn't know what to do. I mean, it's a crime. Obviously, it's a crime. And he reported it, and he was told, well, you know, forget about it. We can't control what the South Vietnamese do. Don't make an issue of it. Other things like that were happening to him. And he was witnessing his boss, and he explained all this to me. His boss was a very senior CIA officer, and he was in charge of Da Nang City, which is up in I Corps. And Bruce, through his Lawler, through his agent net, knew that this guy's girlfriend was a Viet Cong agent. And he went to his senior CIA boss and he said, look, I know your girlfriend's, working for the enemy. And he told me, but they knew the war was winding down and they just wanted to live a good life. This CIA, old time CIA guy, was his last tour. He was going to retire. It wasn't uncommon in Vietnam for a senior, the Vietnamese special police to actually bring a young 14, 15-year-old girl to a CIA officer every night, different one. It's different culture. And these kinds of things and inducements were available. And when you're a CIA officer and you're everything you do is secret, you know, you don't have to put that into a report. And of course, because you're protected and nobody can ever bring you before court in the United States, you can do anything illegal you want and you can get away with it. And all it takes is an old boy network of each of these guys knowing that this is how it works and that, you know, all they have to do is cover for each other and they can get away with it. They're getting away with it all over the world every day in a million ways. And that's how that old boy system works. But Bruce Lawler was only 24 years old, 25 years old, and he hadn't yet got assimilated into this old boy culture. And he actually went to the security officer in Saigon and reported about the rape and the murder of this woman and about his senior boss being involved in having a girlfriend who was, you know, part of the enemy infrastructure. And within a week, Bruce Lawler was sent home. Okay? You know, so the security forces within the CIA, within the FBI, they don't exist to enforce rules or laws. They exist to enforce the old boy network and to allow these guys to get away with this. I mean, and if you, the worst thing that you can do, you know, ask somebody like Snowden or John Kiriakou. Kiriakou ended up spending a couple of years in prison because he all he did was mention another CIA officer's name. The one thing you can't do in the CIA is, you know, rat out all the corruption that's going on. It's just like being in the NYPD. You can rip off people left and right all day long. The one thing you can't do is break the code of silence. And that's the same thing that's going on in the CIA. And that's why I said at the beginning of this conversation that if you're successful because you lie, steal, and cheat and murder, well, those become the things that you're going to use in their bureaucracy. And that's exactly what happens. But you can't know about it because these are secret organizations. And they're, you know, supposedly they're secret because they're doing all this good work overthrowing Russia or something, you know. But it's really just to preserve all the prerogatives and the freedoms that they have in the security services themselves or in the police force themselves. And they rationalize it by saying, well, we have to live these lives because we're on the front lines and we get very small paychecks and we have to supplement our incomes somehow. You know, a cop says, well, I can't send my kids to college on the paycheck I get. So if I want to send my kids to college, well, then I got to let the Jamaicans beat up the Colombians and take over the drug trade in my neighborhood. You know, and then because the drug trade is going to go on anyway, so I got to let somebody do it. So, you know, if somebody's going to give me some money, then I can send my kids to college. So all these things go into it. Anyway, at the same time, in order to become part of this old boy network, whether it's in the NYPD or the FBI or the CIA, as happened to Lawler, you have to give up a part of yourself. And Lawler went through all this training, and he really believed in fighting communism. And even though he got sent back home after reporting on all the corruption he saw, and even though they actually kicked him out of the CIA, there was a part of him that always longed to get back in. And a couple of years later, he actually went back down to Washington, D.C., Lawler's from Vermont, and he went to see William Colby, who was also brought up in Vermont. And Colby tried to get him back into the CIA, and it didn't really work. So he went back into the he'd been a reserve officer in the military, but he wanted to be part of this. So Colby helped him getting back into the military, and all of a sudden, through the 1990s, he started rising very quickly through the military. And by 1999, he was actually in general, heading a special joint coordination force within NATO or something. I can't remember exactly, but he had given up his law practice and become a full-time military officer. He was a general. And when the Department of Homeland Security was created in 2001, Bruce Lawler became its chief of staff. And all of a sudden, you have a guy who's still trying to prove, whose personal motivation is to prove that he really is one of the old boys, that he's sorry that he ratted out all his bosses back there in Vietnam. Please give me a chance, and I'll show you guys that I'm really one of you. Now, he gets appointed chief of staff of the Department of Homeland Security when it's created. And all sorts of people were complaining about because they didn't understand what he was doing, and they couldn't understand why he was doing certain things. And I wrote him a letter. It was actually an open letter, which was published in Counterpunch about a week after he got appointed to this position, and I said, hey, Bruce, are you still working for the CIA? I mean, are you a CIA plant in the Department of Homeland Security? Are you actually working for them? And are you, you know, helping to organize this new organization in a way that makes it possible for the CIA to infiltrate them and to place people that it wants in positions of power there? And of course, you know, that was, again, I didn't come up through the Columbia School of Journalism. You know, I mean, I was, you know, asked it, you know, and of course he never responded, but you don't know. you know, a guy like him could always be, even if he's not actually a CIA officer, so ideologically in sync with them and has the context, I mean, that he could actually be a CIA asset at the highest level of the Department of Homeland Security. And if you think it doesn't happen, think again, because it does happen. And there was an awful lot of people from the Phoenix program and from the CIA who moved out of the CIA, either into positions of to hold public office or into law enforcement or the DEA or the FBI or some other organization, who maintain their CIA contacts, come up through another channel and find themselves in the Department of Homeland Security. And certainly the ideology, as they are, it infects the whole thing of the only way we can get these bad guys is to be worse than them, to be more devious. And that's how crime and law enforcement become indistinguishable. And the tactics that are used in crime and law enforcement are exactly the same, except that one group wears the mantle of legitimacy, you know, and the other, you know, they're the immigrants or the outcasts who are just trying to get into the establishment, and they don't have lawyers writing tax laws, you know, to get them off of like a guy like Trump. You know, so he doesn't have to pay $1 billion in taxes that he owes, which, of course, is a much bigger crime than anything that that the minions are doing, you know, that the nobodies are doing that are getting arrested and put in jail. You know, I mean, the massive crime is conducted systematically, like I quote that fella at the beginning of my book saying, you know, the violence of guns is for the amateur. You know, the violence of aircraft carrier fleets, of nuclear weapons, of Department of Justice that's essentially racist. You know, that kind of violence, that kind of terror. Well, that's the problems of our rulers. And it's all legal because they make it legal for them to do it. And yet it's no less criminal to be not paying $1 billion in taxes. Just as you're a billionaire, that's what you're allowed to do. Anyway, so I could go on and on with, there's all sorts of in this book, the CIA organized crime. I present a couple of cases of people who worked for the CIA or special forces and then carry this whole philosophy with them into their public life.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, How the CIA Corrupts the System. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You also comment in your book that you observe that the personality traits of criminals and those who go into law enforcement or the CIA or whatever, that they have very similar personality traits.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I interviewed a man named Nelson Brickham, who was the guy who created the Phoenix program. I think I might have told you about him in our previous interview. And Brickham was, I mean, so some of these people are funny, you know? I mean, and they were very forthcoming with me because they thought, you know, because William Colby sent me, you know, that it was okay to tell me everything. And Brickham said it was his feeling, based on 20 years of experience, that the average CIA officer was just a frustrated mercenary, a guy who, if he wasn't educated, hadn't gone to Harvard or Yale or Columbia, and hadn't joined the CIA, would have been a mercenary. This is CIA officers telling me this. And he wasn't the only one. When you meet these guys, whether they're in the DEA, you know, I mean, a DEA guy who goes undercover into the Medellin cartel, you know, you can't fake it. You can't join a drug trafficking organization and fake it. You know, I mean, you've got to have in you the larceny. You got to have the psychopathology. You got to be a bit of a sociopath. And it's the same thing with the CIA. I mean, I have some of those traits myself, I confess. And that's one of the reasons these guys liked me. You know, I could walk into a room with them, you know, in a bar and have a couple of drinks, and we could look at each other and say, let's cause some trouble, you know, let's see what we can get away with. If I wasn't that way, if I had been a good guy, they never would have trusted me and talked to me. You got to be somewhat felonious in order for them to even begin to trust her. You can't ride with a cop in a patrol car if he thinks you're going to rat him out. You know, I mean, you're out the door. So anyway, Brigham said this to me, and it was my experience, having known all these guys, federal narcotic agents, cops, CIA officers, that it's absolutely true. And there is no really difference between a CIA officer who can go and wipe out a family or send somebody to go wipe out a family, because it's what the CIA calls psychological warfare. And it's going to suppress the bad guys. They know that we're going to go get your family and we're going to wipe them out. And they think it's funny. You know, we can do this and we can get away with it. And that's the mentality that these people exhibit. And they can't rat it out, and they ideologically, they become so indoctrinated that they think that when they commit crimes, it's okay. They think they're above the law.
What is the relationship between the Drug Enforcement Administration, that is the DEA, and the CIA? Is it as simple, at least at one point, as the DEA fighting drug trafficking and the CIA promoting it?
It's a long history that evolves to some extent. Okay. Nowadays, the DEA is basically an adjunct overseas of the CIA. And of course, Afghanistan is the showcase example. The Taliban, when it took power in 1999 or 2000, first thing it did was it outlawed opium production. And the amount of opium coming out of Afghanistan decreased. After the CIA took over in 2002, opium production in Afghanistan skyrocketed. And it has become, since the CIA took over in Afghanistan and the military started occupying that country, for the last 15 years, Afghanistan has provided like 90% of the heroin to the United States. You can believe the published reports that the DEA puts out, and it says, well, it's the Taliban did it. You know, I mean, but it's like, you know, your dog pees on your rug, and then you come in and he says, well, the Russians did it. You know, I mean, you can believe your eyes, or you can believe what they're reporting to you. But it's in a country like Afghanistan, the DEA serves the function of making sure that the warlords on the CIA's payroll are able to deal narcotics. If somebody in the Taliban tries to deal narcotics, then the DEA descends on them. But it's political. It's totally political, and it's considered national security. It's more important for the United States to have political control of Afghanistan. And the only way they can have political control is if they deal with gangsters who deal narcotics and are willing to sell out their own country in order to make a couple of million dollars. And then, you know, later on, you know, get construction deals. You know, they're diversified. The warlords that are on the CIA's payroll, you know, I mean, they speculate in the market. They are involved in vast, you know, always funneling their illegal narcotic profits into legitimate enterprises, you know, and they make, build up a political party and control the country. But that's how it works. And it worked that way in South Vietnam used to be the absolute example of this. And I discovered this while investigating the Phoenix program. For example, I was talking once with this guy named Robert Slater. And he ran the interrogation program in South Vietnam with the special police that I mentioned earlier. The CIA paid to have an interrogation center built in each of the 44 provinces in South Vietnam. And it was this guy Slater's job, and he had a team of Americans he worked with, to train the South Vietnamese special policemen who staffed these interrogation centers. And he would inspect them, and he would ride around with a team of special branch officers, and they would go to this province or that province, and they would, you know, inspect these interrogation centers and make sure everybody was writing reports properly and manning the outposts properly, all the different things. It was a bureaucracy. I remember Slater telling me that this, the team that he traveled around the country with, they all smoked opium on the Air America planes while they were flying around. You know, the Vietnamese did not think about opium the way we think about opium. You know, these are like they're FBI agents, and they're smoking opium on their way to inspect a, you know, an interrogation center. It's a bizarre situation there in South Vietnam. It was part of the culture to smoke opium. They didn't have the a lot of pharmacies and have a lot of doctors. Rural people would smoke opium, you know, to reduce pain for certain, you know, as medicine. The whole society was permeated it. And in order to keep the generals and the politicians and the policemen that were on their payroll, the CIA had to allow these people to dabble in narcotics and to actually import tons of opium from Laos, where it was grown and where the CIA actually had an army that it financed through the growing of opium. And then it was sold to people in South Vietnam. So, you know, they controlled, the CIA controlled both ends of the operation. It grew it and made money, supported its army in Laos by growing it and then selling it to the South Vietnamese, who then sold it to American soldiers. Addiction in South Vietnam became a huge problem for the army. But if they, and again, here's the relationship between crime and law enforcement. If the CIA didn't control the opium trade, then the Viet Cong would have controlled it. And then they would have made the money from it. And then they would have been able to buy politicians. So the CIA was forced, you know, or at least they say they were forced through the reality of the situation to control the opium trade. And that's what they did. They monopolized it. And that's what they do all over the world. They monopolized the opium trade internationally for the same exact reasons they did it in South Vietnam and the same reason they do it in Afghanistan. Because if they don't control it, then the bad guys, the people that they think are their enemies, will control it. They'll make the money, and they'll control the underworld and be able to buy their politicians and put their people in place to control the political and social movements. And that's the reality. And the DEA, like I said, is an adjunct overseas of this policy. And any report you read is totally fabricated that says anything otherwise.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, How the CIA Corrupts the System. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Speaking of the drug trade in South Vietnam, you wrote an article called The Clash of Icons. What was that about?
Well, you know, when you do a book like I did on the CIA, you find out all sorts of things that don't actually make it into the book. And as I told you the last time we spoke, I got entree into the CIA through William Colby, who was a director of Central Intelligence. And just briefly, he was a person that ran the FedEx program in South Vietnam for a couple of years, went back to the United States and became director of Central Intelligence. He liked me. I went to approach him around 1984, told him I wanted to write a book about FedEx. For some reason, he liked me, and he started introducing me to CIA people that he thought would be very helpful to me. And he introduced me to a guy named Frank Scotton. And Frank Scotton is this tremendously charismatic character. I mean, he's from Boston. His father was killed in World War II in the Battle of the Bulge or something like that. And he's a very patriotic guy. He went to American University, where he graduated around 1960, 1961. He went to East-West Center in Hawaii around 1961, where he learned how to run agent nets. I was told he joined the United States Information Service, the USIS, which is the overseas branch of the United States Information Agency. And in late 1961, early 1962, Frank Scotton ended up in Vietnam. And Colby sent me to Scotton because Scotton was a pioneer in developing a couple of the programs that were incorporated into the Phoenix program 5 years later. One of those programs was called Armed Propaganda Teams. When Scotton got to Vietnam in 1962, we weren't at war with the country yet. And he was put way up in the highlands working with Montagnards, mountain people who were kind of looked down upon by the Vietnamese. And there was a bunch of Brits there. The Brits were kind of, they were the experts on how to organize indigenous people because they had done that in Malaysia. And he fell under the influence of these Brits. And he started getting involved in these very, very clandestine kind of psychological warfare operations where they adopted communist techniques of trying to promote the government line in villages, understanding that the communists had infiltrated this area. And Scotton was trying to set up programs that would convince the people to come over to the government side. Going into these remote villages, I remember he told me once they would drop leaflets or, tell people that, you know, we're going to bring you democracy. And they were on the outskirts of a village, and he shot a flare gun into the sky at night, and they yelled, "Walk to the light." You know, like the Bible begins, you know, "Let there be light." You know, they were trying to find ways to convince very rural people to come over to the side of the government. And Scotton put these armed propaganda teams together. And these armed propaganda teams had a component that was called a counterterror team. And they would go into a village where the communists had influence and had put a communist agent in the village in order to control the behaviors of the people in that village. And Scotton's counterterror team would pull him into the middle of the village and say, "We know this guy works for the communists," and they would chop his head off and put it on a stake. And they would say, "If you do this sort of stuff, if you, you know, collaborate with the communists, this is going to happen to you." And they say that they were doing this because the communists were doing it, and they had to do it. If they were going to compete with the communists, they had to be as brutal as them. This counter-terror facet of Scotton's armed propaganda teams became one of the two foundation stones of the Phoenix program. This counter-terror, you know, being able to go into enemy villages with small units and commit atrocities. That was one of the two foundation stones, the other being the interrogation centers that I was just telling you about. Anyway, so Scotton was widely known within the CIA and the intelligence community in South Vietnam for having devised these programs. In 1965, a young Marine Corps captain named Dan Ellsberg was sent to Vietnam. And Ellsberg was sent to work with a guy named General Lansdale, who was in charge of what was called the Revolutionary Development Program in Vietnam at that time. the Revolutionary Development Program had incorporated Scotton's armed propaganda teams as its centerpiece and its counterterrorism function, and it was expanding it just like with the interrogation centers. It started out of a little village here and a district there, and they were making it national in 1965. And the Pentagon sent Daniel Ellsberg out to work with Lansdale and Scotton and to observe and report on how this revolutionary development program was playing out. And Dan Ellsberg lived with Frank Scotton for a year, and they were best friends. Anyway, Colby sent me to interview Scotton, you know? And I was talking with Scotton about all these programs that he put together and which I wrote about extensively. And out of the blue, he said, oh, and by the way, I lived with Dan Ellsberg for a year. I said, you mean Dan Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers? He said, oh, yeah. You know, Dan was one of us. All these things that we did, all these kind of like really clandestine operations where you go out and you put on black pajamas like the Viet Cong, and you go into a village and you hunt down the enemy cadres. Well, Dan went along with us. He did all that stuff with us. And not only that, he said Dan was quite the ladies' man. And he told me a story, which I should say was corroborated by a couple of other people. I mean, Scott wasn't the only one I was talking to. And talking with another guy, Luke Conine, I don't want to be redundant, but these stories were all corroborated by a lot of people. Dan was quite what they call that day a swordsman. And like I told you earlier, just like opium is considered different in South Vietnam, it was a different culture. Well, you know, relations between men and women were also more liberal. Just like I said, it was the South Vietnamese would bring young women to high-ranking CIA officers. There was a it just isn't like it is here. There were not a lot. The rules were a lot looser. And anyway, Dan was having a field day, and one of the women that Dan Ellsberg got involved with was a young woman named Germaine. And Germaine was one quarter French and three quarters Vietnamese. She was connected with a whole group of French Corsicans, some of whom had been trafficking in opium in South Vietnam and Laos for many years. And Dan started a relationship with this young woman, Germaine, even though he knew that she was the girlfriend of a Corsican drug trafficker named Miguel Seguin. And this is in the summer of 1965. Scotton was telling me the story, and he said, well, it almost blew up the entire underworld, this relationship. And this guy, Miguel Seguin, let it be known that he was going to kill Dan. And he said, the stories about how it actually unfolded are slightly different, but they're all basically the same thing. Miguel Seguin sent an assassin to kill Dan Ellsberg because he was romancing his girlfriend. And Scotton and Lou Conine, Conine, who had been in the CIA for 20 years at that point, 15, 20 years, actually had to go to the Corsican underworld and tell him to back off and not kill Dan, or else there would be a gang war in Saigon between the CIA and the Corsicans. Okay? So it's a fabulously interesting story. And I asked Dan Ellsberg about it, and he said, well, he had a slightly different version of it. He said that this guy Seguin actually came to the villa where he lived with Scotton and put a gun to his head and said, stay away from my girlfriend, I'll kill you. And then I asked Dan Ellsberg, well, were the Corsicans dealing drugs? Was the CIA involved in that aspect of the underworld? And he flatly denied it. He said that his boss, Ed Lansdale, General Ed Lansdale, who he really admired and he considered a mentor. Lansdale had been in the Philippines in the early 1950s, and he had put down the communist insurrection there. And then in 54, he was sent to South Vietnam to do the same thing. And he's Lansdale, the guy that put ZM in power. Lansdale was there until 1958. And Conine, Lou Conine, was with Lansdale that whole time. Conine came back to South Vietnam around 61 or 62. Conine was the guy who was the liaison between the CIA and the generals that assassinated the ZM in 1963. Conine was still there in 65 when Lansdale came back. So you had Lansdale, Conine, Scott, and Ellsberg all working together. There's a very famous photograph of Conine and Ellsberg in a boat together. But when it comes to the CIA and drugs, Dan says, no, there was no relationship. Whereas Conine told Al McCoy, who wrote a very famous book called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, that in 1965, the CIA actually made a deal with the Corsicans that not to interfere in their drug running as long as the Corsicans served as informants for the CIA. So I wrote this article that gets very elaborate. And it's called The Clash of the Icons. Do you believe, on the one hand, Dan Ellsberg, who worked intimately with all these CIA guys for many years, and saying that there no, the CIA wasn't involved in drugs? Or do you believe Al McCoy, who spent many years researching the subject and shows beyond any doubt that the CIA was controlling the whole business, you know, that, it documented the whole thing. You know, I mean, who are you going to believe? And the other thing that Scott told me, which was kind of controversial, was that he had actually put Ellsberg up to releasing the Pentagon Papers. And I asked Dan about that as well. And he said, no, it absolutely wasn't true. Scott, when I saw him, was, sort of laughed, and he said, we are the ones that put Ellsberg up to releasing the Pentagon Papers, and we, meaning Colby and him, I didn't ask anything more about it at the time, but I did ask Dan about it. He denied it again, and apparently he already had the Pentagon Papers in his possession when in late 1970, when Scott showed up at his house and saw the Pentagon Papers there, and it may have, you know, there may have been some conversation about it at that point, but in an autobiography that he wrote recently, Scott denies having put Ellsberg up to do it, although he did tell me that they did. So anyway, you come across these kind of things, and they... they're the kind of insights into what the CIA does in terms of corrupting foreign officials. Like, for example, Neil Sheehan was part of this group, the New York Times reporter. He was there. He knew Scott. He knew Ellsberg. Back in those days, Halberstam was there. They knew these guys intimately. They partied together. They knew everything that was going on at this very intimate level. And yet they didn't report on it. You know, they didn't talk about this kind of aspect of how CIA officers in their private lives, the kinds of things that they're involved in, the way that they would integrate into the culture, the way they would work and maneuver through the underworld, how they would spy on the special policemen or the hit teams that they were working on. How, you know, they would spy on them and talk back to the CIA about these things because you're not allowed to report anything about the CIA. So there's this whole secret history of the Vietnam War that exists at this very intimate level that nobody ever knows about or has ever heard about. And the story that I wrote about Ellsberg, which I confirmed it all, you know, I did talk to him and tell him everything, you know, for his opinions. It's just a part of our history is a part of world history that nobody ever gets to know. And the only way you ever get to know about it is if these guys accept you into their old boy network. And the only way that they're going to do that is if you're as felonious as they are, and if they really think that you're like them, you know. And I guess that was one of the characteristics I had. I didn't mind making some trouble if that's what it took, you know. So anyway, that's that story. And it involves the CIA's involvement in narcotic trafficking. That's what's at the center of it.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, How the CIA Corrupts the System. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And what about Al McCoy, the author that you referred to in your story, The Clash of Icons, who wrote about the trafficking in heroin in Southeast Asia? Did anything happen to him on account of having done that research and written that book?
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, everybody knows about Gary Webb, the guy who did the expose on the CIA's involvement with the Contras. And Gary Webb was denounced by the American media for having exaggerated and made a few little small mistakes and lost his job and ended up allegedly committing suicide out of despair. Well, McCoy suffered, too. The CIA tried to prevent his book from being published. One of the guys who was very senior in the CIA at the time, named Cord Meyer, who had run the CIA's Operation Mockingbird, which was the CIA's effort to control the media in the United States, which started in the 50s and went through the 60s and was exposed by Bernstein around 74. This guy, Cord Meyer, went to the publisher, McCoy's publisher, who he knew from school. You know, I mean, they went foxtrotting together and hanged out at the same Georgetown social circles. You know, I think I explained to you last time that at the highest levels, the CIA and the media are the same people, whether it's the CIA and the publishing industry or the CIA and Hollywood. They're the same people. There's no distinction. And so Cord Meyer didn't want the book to be published. And he went to McCoy's publisher and asked him not to do it. And to his credit, the guy said, no, let the book come out. But McCoy was so hounded. And a lot of the CIA officers that he interviewed changed their stories and said, no, I didn't say that. You know, I would never say that. And McCoy ended up having to leave in the United States and went and lived in Australia for 10 years. Thought he'd never get another book published here. You know, I mean, if you reveal the CIA's secrets, especially about its biggest, darkest secret, which is his control of international drug trafficking, you're going to pay a price. And basically, the first price is that nobody will ever publish you again in the United States. It's hard. Believe me, you know, the CIA kept a file on me. And they did everything they could to try to prevent my book from coming out. When I started doing my research into the CIA's involvement in drug trafficking, it was in the early 1990s. And there were still a lot of DEA officers who were resisting the CIA through the systems analysis theory. The CIA has been able to take over by placing people who sympathize with it or who are actually CIA officers into the DEA over a period of 25, 30 years. They were actually able to take over the DEA senior management. They were able to take over its intelligence and foreign operations. They infiltrated the DEA. I talk about that in my books, how they did it, through, you know, manipulating Congress and having the right political people put in. There's just a million ways, and they use them all. But in 1994, just to give you an example, I got an interview with the guy who was the acting administrator of the DEA at that time, a guy named Steve Green. And he didn't want to do the interview. But his public affairs chief, a guy named Bill Ruzzamenti, set up the interview for me. That's kind of funny because I took a plane down that morning. I got a train. It was snowing. I had two suitcases with me. I was wearing this big London fog raincoat. And I took a train to Pentagon City, and I walked into the DEA business building carrying two suitcases and wearing this trench coat. Obviously, this was before 9/11. And nobody bat an eye. I went to the front desk and I'm here to see Ruzumene. And they called up, and Ruzumene came down in that elevator. And I got into the elevator with my bags and my coat. And we went up to the executive suite where this guy, Steve Green, had his office. And Ruzumene sat me down, got me a cup of coffee, and he said, I'm going to tell you something, and if you ever tell anybody, I'll deny it. He said, but yesterday the CIA called up, and they told us not to go through with this interview with you. They said, the CIA said to us, Valentine's trying to get at us through you. Don't talk to him. Now, in a free society, this sort of thing wouldn't happen, you know, but it's an old boy network. And they were following me around, and they were surveilling me, and they knew everybody I was going to see, and they were always trying to get people not to talk to me, which, of course, is an infringement on my First Amendment rights. But anybody who gets into the investigating the CIA should understand from the beginning you don't have any right. And I understood that. And I was just willing to try and finesse my way through it. And Ruzumene said, so what do you have to say about that? I said, well, Bill, I'm writing a book about the DEA, but if I find out that the CIA was involved in any way or if they were interfering in your operations, I'm going to write about that. And he said, great, that's exactly what I wanted to hear. Nowadays, that doesn't work anymore. There is no more. There are no more Bill Ruzumentes in the DEA. There are no more people who are resisting the CIA in this absolutely total corruption of the entire bureaucratic system within the United States. It doesn't exist anymore. I absolutely loathe Donald Trump, but he is expressing with his recent battle with the CIA the fact that there is this old boys club that has been completely corrupted within, that is managing the system. And when he says the system's rigged, he's right. It totally is. And the CIA is at the heart of it. And they've taken over every institution in the country that in any way has anything to do with foreign operations. Because in the world that we live in today, there really is no more distinction between domestic and foreign operations. Everything is integrated and in so many ways. And, Trump represents in his sort of nativist way an effort to, Brexit, to retain some kind of integrity to a state itself and to take back, control over your own fate. Rather than having these internationalists, TPP and all that stuff, selling your jobs away and stuff like that. Now, of course, it's all rhetoric with Trump. I have no idea whether he actually, intends to do any of these things. He's a billionaire, but it really is true. And they have taken over. They've taken over in the same way that they've taken over the DEA. They've taken over Homeland Security, as I was explaining to you earlier, with the appointment of these guys like Lawler. And they've taken over the Homeland Security, again, because the threat of terrorism, it's not just a domestic thing. It can't be. There's no way to separate it out from what's going on overseas. So the CIA has to be involved because they're the only ones that know what's going on overseas in these ways. So everything has become integrated. And the only people that really have all the knowledge about what's going on overseas and are able to control it and have been putting in the systems of control for the last 75 years is the CIA. And that cabal of good old boys that have really, really just taken over the security services, and they use it like a mafia to fatten themselves. and their sponsors, and many of whom are in the arms industry and have nothing to gain by peace around the world and having peaceful relations with China or Russia or any other country. They make their money through conflict, and the CIA is the tool that provokes the conflicts all around the world. And that's why it's clandestine, is because it's serving this function. And the United States at this point in its history has become totally dependent on that system of provoking conflicts and having conflict that is totally irrational and unnecessary, other than serving these people who control this system.
Douglas Valentine, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly
clear. There's a man with a gun over there. I've been speaking with Douglas Valentine. Today's show has been How the CIA Corrupts the System. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, about the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology, With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. His latest book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, available at claritypress.com. Visit his website at douglasvalentine.com. That's douglasvalentine.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yarrow Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, the show is about climate change. Here, seldom is heard an encouraging word. But we do have some encouraging words today from climate scientist Tim Flannery. I hope you'll stay tuned. I try to keep a sense of humor about things, but if New World Notes has a fault, that's a joke. The show has about 75 faults. Anyway, if the show has a fault, it is that our installments sometimes are a bit heavy on the gloom and doom, especially when we discuss the ongoing, the unrelenting destruction of the Earth's environment. Global climate change. So it was a rare delight to find a serious climate scientist who says that the situation is plenty bad for sure, but maybe we can avoid total disaster. Dr. Timothy Flannery. Tim Flannery is an Australian environmental scientist and climate change activist. He has a new book on the subject titled Atmosphere of Hope: Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. He spoke in Seattle a few weeks ago, in November 2015. Mike McCormick captured the audio of his talk, and I have whittled the hour-long presentation down to about 25 minutes. Flannery offers a large handful of partial solutions. Several of these are high-tech and not yet tested on a large scale. But importantly, these high-tech solutions are not like the scary and dangerous geoengineering schemes that our industrial and military technocrats keep coming up with. Some of the solutions are here now. Solar electricity and windmill electricity are established. They're cheaper than coal, and they work. On the other hand, turning atmospheric CO2 into carbon fiber, well, that technology is not ready for prime time just yet. But it's doable, and it has been done on a small scale. None of these technologies is adequate in itself to halt global climate change. All of them together might still not be good enough. But what the heck, at least they offer and warrant some real hope. At least they could buy us some time to work out better solutions. We will skip over Flannery's own catalog of gloom and doom and pick up at the point where he shifts to the hopeful stuff. Here is Tim Flannery.
So what's changed that gives me hope? I just want to talk about one relatively small thing first, but I think it's quite telling. The International Energy Agency earlier in the year produced a report that really surprised me. And it surprised me because the International Energy Agency is hardly some screaming radical green organisation. You know, it has its own coal unit and its experts in fossil fuel use and all the rest of it. So the report they produced was quite astonishing. What it said, or the bottom line of the report, was basically that in 2014, the global economy grew at a time when emissions from the burning of fossil fuels for energy use stalled. So the fossil fuels we consumed for energy use didn't grow between 2013 and 2014, and yet the global economy grew. This was astonishing to me because we're used to seeing developed countries decouple economic growth from emissions growth. The US has done it, Australia's done it, Canada's done it, Europe's done it. But to think that it would happen at the global scale in 2014 is amazing. No one was expecting that decoupling to occur so early. Two of the drivers, I think, that are responsible for that outcome are, first, incredible success of clean energy technologies in terms of penetrating the marketplace. And secondly, what I'll call for the moment energy efficiency, but we'll come back to that. Just to deal with the clean energy first, You know, I've watched year on year as solar panels have been producing cheaper and cheaper electricity. You know, for the last 30 years, they've dropped the price of electricity 10% a year. They've got, you know, it's amazing outcomes. The wind sector has been the same, and the wind sector and solar have got a long way to go. Costs are going down. I work with Siemens, or I have worked with Siemens for a decade, and particularly their wind sector, and I see what they're doing. I mean, they're totally revolutionising the production of wind turbines. They no longer have gears in their wind turbines. They have these gearless wind turbines where the head itself is the turbine. There's hundreds less moving parts. The maintenance costs are way, way down. The blades of wind turbines run out, obviously, and have to be replaced. They're like propeller blades on an aeroplane. You know, they start to corrode over time. What Siemens are doing with these, and imagine a 90-metre-long turbine blade, you know, they're putting little 3D printers on the blades that run all the way up and back and just keep that blade in absolutely top condition. So, again, maintenance costs are down. If you're putting your turbines offshore, that counts a lot. The least maintenance you need to do, the better. So the cost of electricity from wind turbines in future is going to be about half of what it is now. So, I mean, these technologies are just taking over the marketplace. For 3 years running, we've had more investment in clean tech than we've had in fossil fuels in the energy sector. It's just it's an enormous change. So that's part of that decoupling, I think. But the other part that I would argue is at least as important as what I called energy efficiency. In this country, your year of peak oil demand is way, way in the past. In my country of Australia, our year of peak coal demand was 6 years ago. You know, so all of those efficiency gains means that we're using less and less fossil fuels, which is getting us, you know, helping contribute to that decoupling that I mentioned. And I think we deserve a pat on the back. It's nights like this where everyone gets together who has been doing this sort of stuff. We need to recognise we've had a massive success. As kind of tedious as it is doing all of those small things that seem to not add up to anything, they've actually added up to a huge outcome in my view. So I think that's really important. 5 years before the Paris meeting agreement will start to take effect, which is 2020, we're seeing this decoupling. It might just buy us some time that we didn't think we had to get below 2 degrees. But as I said, there's enough gas in the air now to take us to 1.5 degrees of warming, and I really hate that. I hate that fact. I really do, because it's going to cost me my barrier reef and my children the opportunity to see that marvellous thing. And my third cause of hope really came from a meeting that I had in 2007 with Sir Richard Branson. He had read The Weathermakers and invited me to Necker Island, where he has a house, and wanted to talk about climate change and what he could do about it. Back then, I was pretty optimistic we were going to get a good outcome at Copenhagen and we'd be able to get on top of this problem. Richard didn't believe that for a second. He just said, I just don't think that humanity is capable of doing what needs to be done to avoid the problem. He said, what I'd like to do is to set up a prize for technologies that have the capacity to draw enough CO2 out of the air to make a difference to our climate future. So we ended up calling it the Virgin Earth Challenge Prize. It's a £25 million prize, and it's for technologies that have the potential to draw 1 gigaton of carbon out of the atmosphere per annum. Now, when he set that up in 2007, I agreed to be a judge on the prize panel, but I was very pessimistic that we'd get entries that would amount to anything. 8 years later, we've had 11,000 entries. I've looked through them, I've carefully evaluated them, and I have become totally convinced that this approach of drawing CO2 out of the atmosphere is going to be an indispensable part of our future. One of the things I found frustrating was that this wasn't being recognised anywhere. That we didn't even have a name for this basket of technologies before. You know, some of the approaches people would refer to as geoengineering, others to agricultural practices and so forth, but there wasn't a name. So when I wrote my book, I thought I'll coin a name for this. I'll call it the third way. The reason I called it the third way is that the first and most vital way is reducing emissions. We all recognise that. That's what we've got to do. The second way, however, is geoengineering, but geoengineering in really damaging ways. And I can see that the second way will be used if we dally much longer in this. And Let me just explain the sort of geoengineering that people are considering at the moment. One of the options, and probably the cheapest and most widely favoured option, is to inject some sort of sulphur-based chemicals into the stratosphere, which is, you know, 12 kilometres or so above our head, up where the jetliners fly. If you do that, you have an instant effect cooling the planet. We know that because large volcanoes sometimes erupt sufficient sulphur into the stratosphere to cool Earth, and we get these years without a summer. We know that happens. There's enough research being done on those options to show that it's really quite cheap. There's a few people who are probably living within 20 miles of us now who could individually fund a geoengineering proposal like that would change the climate of the Earth. It's not that expensive, and there's probably more than one that could do it. So we know it's cheap. We know it's instantly effective, right? Really does lower the temperature straight away. So if you're facing some dire problems related to temperatures, you can fix them. The third thing we know about the second way, geoengineering, using sulphur and so forth, is that it is incredibly dangerous. It's dangerous because it has the potential to change Earth's weather circulation patterns. So we know that if you put sulphur into the stratosphere, you will affect the South Asian monsoon. There's 1.4 billion people who depend upon that monsoon for a living. We know that the productivity of crops will decline. It's what's happened in years without a summer in the past when the sulphur's gone up naturally. And we know that underneath that sulphur, the problem of climate change will just keep festering away. The CO2 will keep increasing, the oceans will acidify, the very basis of life itself will be eroded. And if anyone decides that they've got to stop putting the sulphur up precipitously for any reason, the rebound in the climate system is likely to be extremely dangerous. The bad news is that there are a number of government agencies worldwide working on geoengineering solutions. The government of China alone has four major institutes or four major research groups working on these geoengineering solutions. China is likely to be quite severely affected by climate change, and China is run by technocrats and engineers who understand that problem very well, and they're hedging their bets. So the second way is something we want to avoid. The third way technologies I outline in the book are really different from the second way. They're all characterised by approaches, methods or technologies that strengthen Earth's self-regulatory system by pulling excess CO2 out of the atmospheres in ways that the Earth system already uses or in ways that basically simulate or mimic the way the Earth system operates. So it's dealing with the problem at base. I want to explain about some of those 11,000 solutions that we've seen in the prize and also some others that have come in subsequently. All of the approaches, all of the third way approaches really fall into two basic categories. One is, I can call the biological pathways. They depend upon sunlight as their power source and plants as the capture mechanism. They're really, really well understood. You know, reforestation, growing plants and somehow storing the carbon. I think that first example I gave you about Australia and how many trees you need to plant to draw down 4 gigatons gives you a sense of the limits of the biological systems, though. You know, we're already asking Earth's system, particularly its land-based ecosystems, to feed us and house us and clothe us, provide our clean water and fresh air and everything else. So there are limits to the amount I think we can do on land when we're dealing with a problem that is of many gigatons in scale. I think they'll contribute, but I don't think they'll be the full answer. So reforestation, it'll be an important tool, but it won't provide the full answer. It can't. It's just not of a scale that allows it to do it. The biochar industry, fantastic industry, and there's been great advances made here in the US and other parts of the world, is another option. And with biochar, you take plant matter, turn it into charcoal, put it in the soil, and the carbon will stay there long term, so it's out of the atmosphere, drawn out by the plants and then put into the soil. The old wood chemistry industries that used to be so prolific in this country might make a comeback. You know, before we had the petrochemical industries, we got all of our, you know, plastics and many of our other chemicals from the old wood chemical industry. Chemists knew how to take cellulose and various other plant products and make a lot of valuable products from them. It may be that we'll start doing that at scale. Maybe that'll get us some gigatons, but it won't get us anywhere near where we need to be. You really have to leave the land surface and go to the oceans if you want to have great opportunity in terms of this. But with that great opportunity comes a vast increase in the unknowns and the uncertainties. The seaweed that grows off the coast here in Seattle, that can grow at the rate of half a metre a day. It grows 30 to 60 times faster than any land-based plants. And there was a great study done last year suggesting that if we could only cover 9% of the world's oceans in seaweed farms, we could draw down all of the atmospheric CO2 we put up in any one year. So offset completely the current emissions. And also, because the seaweed takes CO2 out of the atmosphere and buffers the ocean waters and makes them less acid, we could grow enough high-quality protein in the form of fish and seashells and prawns to give 200 kilograms per year to a population of 10 billion people. So I thought, that's fantastic. This sounds like the magic, the silver bullet that we've all been looking for, you know. But then I started looking into the problem a bit and thinking about it a bit more seriously. 9% of the world's oceans turns out to be a not insubstantial area. It's about 4.5 times the size of Australia, to be honest. So, you know, we have about 500 square kilometres of seaweed farms off China when there's mixed aquaculture and seaweed farming. We sort of know how they work, but to go from that to even 1% of the world's ocean is an unbelievably large exercise. And then, you know, it occurred to me, what would we do with all of that seaweed? Are we just going to have it laying around in rotting piles or what? One option that's available is you could put the seaweed into biodigesters and you know, make methane, which you'd then burn for electricity and send the electricity onshore, and then maybe take the CO2 from the tailpipe, and where would you put it? Well, one option that's it's only a desktop study at this moment is that you could try to put it in sediments in the ocean, maybe 1 or 2 miles down, and at that depth, the CO2 remains liquid. The pressure of the water column above it means that the CO2 doesn't try to escape all the time. So it's quite different from putting CO2 into land-based rocks, where, you know, there it's buoyant, it wants to escape. But in the ocean, that's not the case. And eventually it would form a solid in those sediments. But this is all just thinking. It's desktop at the moment. But it's possible. I want to just go now to the chemical-based technologies, which are the second great silo, really, of third-way approaches. I call them chemical because they're very, very broad, but they all have one thing in common. They need an energy source, right? And that energy source at the moment is human-created electricity or transport fuels, you know, fossil fuels, to some extent. The first that we need to think about is carbon-negative concretes. I don't know whether any of you have heard of these, but the concrete industry globally is responsible for about 5% of current emissions of greenhouse gases. People have invented this new product called carbon negative concrete, which over its lifetime, as it sits there and cures, it absorbs CO2 into its structure, so it gives us a gain in terms of reducing CO2. Its manufacturers claim that it's, you know, cheaper, stronger and more durable than conventional concretes. So why aren't we all rushing out to use carbon-negative concretes? Well, tragically, or perhaps not so tragically, engineers and others involved in building things are pretty conservative in their approach. They know what Portland cement-based concretes do, and we've got a history going back to Roman times. We know the stuff stands up, right? So no one's going to go out and build a Sydney Harbour Bridge or a World Trade Centre out of carbon-negative concrete at the moment because it doesn't have a track record, you know? But there are things we could do to try to foster that industry. If we had a sectoral cap and trade system just on the concrete sector, that would encourage the manufacture of carbon negative concretes in low risk environments where we could learn about its behaviour over time and start giving it that track record that it needs to start replacing Portland cement based concretes. So there's a huge opportunity there. That opportunity really is on the gigaton scale. The second opportunity in the chemical pathways involves a particular rock type called serpentinites. And I suspect there's quite a lot of serpentinites in this area. They're rocks that form at the mid-ocean ridge, and over geological time they get incorporated, some of them at least, into continents and become just part of the, you know, landscape around us. As those serpentinites weather, they capture CO2 from the atmosphere. And it's a really important part of nature's way of getting rid of CO2 out of the system. If you could quarry and grind up 5 or 6 gigatons of serpentinite, you'd capture 3 or 4 gigatons of CO2. So it's quite a substantial amount. But, of course, the way we quarry things today, you've got to, you know, burn fossil fuels, basically, to drive those trucks and then drive the hammers. It'll break the stuff up, or the mills that break the rock up. But serpentinite is not just a kind of a desktop study. There is a company in the Netherlands at the moment who makes roofing paint, who includes serpentinite in their roofing paint and sells carbon-negative roof paints. Great idea. Never going to add up to a gigaton, but it's a good start. But there are people who are thinking, well, why don't we grind this stuff up on scale and use it to replenish beaches, use it as a substitute for beach sand, because in an active environment like that, it'll start sequestering quite a lot of CO2. Other people think we can use it in playgrounds or as a soil amendment. There's yet others who think maybe we could use serpentinite in the smokestacks of shipping, so that you could capture CO2 from a smokestack, but then drop the serpentinite into the oceans where it'll continue to absorb CO2 out of the ocean water. There's a lot of options there. And I think the greener that we can make our energy sector, the more prospective these opportunities look. You don't want to be burning fossil fuels to capture CO2, but if we can green up our electricity generation and our transport, then I think there's some real opportunities. The other options they're kind of much more prospective, but I do want to just cover off on them. I've held in my hand a little mobile phone cover made of plastic that was created out of atmospheric CO2. I know it's probably the most expensive mobile phone cover in the known universe. In fact, it certainly is, but it exists. You know, people are making plastics out of carbon dioxide drawn from the atmosphere. There's capture mechanisms that are very well known. We can incorporate the CO2 into products. It all takes energy, of course, but those plastics are solidified atmospheric CO2. They're a great way of getting CO2 out of the atmosphere and storing it. If every bit of plastic we created today was made out of atmospheric CO2, you would need to double world plastic production to pull a gigaton of carbon out of the atmosphere. That's about 4 gigatons of CO2. But it'll contribute, I think, over time. Just in the last 2 months, we heard about another fantastic breakthrough, the manufacture of carbon fibres from atmospheric CO2. Now, here in Seattle, you've got to know about carbon fibres. Boeing uses them in their Dreamliner, you know, as the skin of the aircraft. They'd be more widely used if they were cheaper, right? But they're expensive. This technology of creating carbon fibres out of atmospheric CO2 is reported to be able to create those fibres at a fraction the cost of current production methods. Some estimates may be a tenth the cost. That's a massive breakthrough, because once carbon fibres get cheap enough, they'll start competing head-on with aluminium and steel, and they're both really energy and carbon-intensive sectors. So they're taking a problem, atmospheric CO2, and turning it into a very powerful solution. I think, you know, who knows where that'll lead? Who knows? It's just a bare announcement at the moment, but I think there's real potential there. At the other wacky end of the scale, I need to mention this, but South Korean researchers about 6 weeks ago made an announcement that they had discovered a way of activating used coffee grounds to capture atmospheric methane, right? Something I never occurred to me in my whole life could be possible, but they have done it. And, you know, I guess if the Arctic starts melting and lots of methane goes in the atmosphere, we'll all be drinking 100 cups a day and sending the stuff off to South Korea to get activated, and hopefully we'll have some sort of solution. But I just bring it up because it tells you we're at the very beginning of an industry here. And think about it this way, that we know that the CO2 in the atmosphere now will be driving ever more disastrous climate change through to 2050 and beyond. We know that, right? And what that means, we know what the problem is that our children will be trying to solve in 2050, right? We know the third way technologies, at least some of them, are the only way forward to deal with this. But we know also that there's long development pathways for all of these industries. Wind and solar teach us that. You know, it's going to be 30 years before we're at scale with the most prospective of these industries. So we need to start investing now. We need to start reducing emissions at the same time we invest in third way technologies, so they're at scale when we use them. I tried to do an assessment of what I thought, a conservative assessment, I should say, of what I thought third way technologies might be doing in terms of CO2 reductions by 2050. And I came up with a figure that was around about 40% of current emissions. If we can achieve that, it will be stunningly important because it'll help us avoid that 2 degrees of warming. But when I really asked myself honestly whether I'd done a good job with that, I began to doubt it because I thought, I don't know what 2050 is going to be like. I really don't. The only way I can begin to come at it is to throw myself back a century. So let me imagine I'm living in 1915 and I'm trying to imagine 1950 rather than living in 2015 and trying to imagine 2050. And if you do that thought experiment, it's very interesting because in my city of Melbourne in 1915, horse-drawn power was the power on the streets. There may have been a few very early motor vehicles, but horse-drawn power was doing most of the work. The maps that people would have looked at to understand the world in school in 1915 were sort of colour-coded maps that were of countries that were colour-coded according to the empires of Europe that had been there for centuries. There wasn't a single communist country on those maps. You know, the war that was being fought, and my grandfather fought in the First World War, the war that he fought was being fought with cavalry charges in 1915, in part. There wasn't a single tank on a battlefield anywhere in the world in 1915. There was a few biplanes flying up, you know, around the place, and they were used for surveillance, but the generals were saying, oh, they're not really as good as the cavalry surveillance we used to get in the good old days, you know. So imagine that mindset, and then imagine 1950. Nuclear weapons, jet aircraft, half the world living under communism. To someone living in 1915, that would have read as science fiction, right? The changes were just too vast. So when I think about 2050, I think about it in those terms, but also with the knowledge that social, technological and environmental change have all accelerated this century. So when I did a conservative estimate of what might be happening in 2015, I have to admit to myself, I think it is really well and truly conservative. I suspect we will be astonished by what our children will do in 2015, and they'll do it with tools that will utterly transform the total economy. The opportunity that's been created with the tech boom and the green energy boom so far will look like small beer compared with the challenge the third wave presents, because we can count the outcoming gigatons. We know the scale. We know how broad-based these technologies are. They cover almost every sector of the economy. And we know that, you know, if we want to reduce atmospheric CO2 by just one part per million, that's 18 gigatons we've got to take out of the atmosphere. You know, we're already pretty much at 400 parts per million. We know that we started the Industrial Revolution at 280 parts per million. The scale of the challenge is massive, but I have no doubt that the third way can deliver real outcomes. So thank you very much. I'll finish there and take questions.
Australia's Dr. Timothy Flannery, sounding a rare note of hope on climate change. Now it's time for us to skedaddle. On behalf of our entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. We're on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum. Try to speak the truth, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call. I'm sick and tired of
some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the speech by attorney and author Dr. William Pepper, given at the Left Forum in May of 2016. It's been slightly edited to fit into our time frame. The full version can be accessed on YouTube or No Lies Radio. Dr. Pepper's new book, The Plot to Kill King, provides the full truth about the conspiracy behind the King assassination. So let's begin. Here's Dr. William Pepper.
But I think it's important for us all to understand that political assassinations did not start in the 1960s, that they've been a part of human society for a very long period of time as a means of altering structures and change. So if we put all this in a context, I think it gives us a broader picture of what happened that my colleagues have been involved in researching and writing, and that I have had many ways a very depressing period of years in working on. Our moderator said I was James Ilray's lawyer for 10 years until he died. I represent the family of Martin Luther King. Martin King was a friend of mine only during the last year of his life, and I represent currently Sirhan Sirhan and worked for Bob Kennedy in 1964 as a kid when I was his citizens chairman in Westchester County when he ran for Senate. I took on those cases not lightly because I knew the victims quite well, and it took me 10 years to convince myself about Ray's innocence and non-involvement. But let's look at these in a historical way. Going beyond the Sumerians, we can start in Western civilization with Socrates and the compelled assassination of Socrates. And I say it was compelled because he took his own life, so far as we know, but it was compelled. Then we can move on to Caesar, assassins that finished Caesar and changed Roman society and Roman history at that point in time. These are basic early political assassinations. And then we can come, irrespective of religion, to the man known as Jesus, who was also assassinated by power figures and structures in his own time, Orthodox and Jewish leaders, as well as Rome, whom he caused a great deal of discomfort to. And I'm one of those people who has done a fair amount of research on his life for about 17 years when he was in India, and realized that when he went from Lhasa and traversed India, the Brahmins wanted him killed. And he had to flee India and come back to his native land because he was insisting on meeting with untouchables. And he was threatening a structure that to this day exists. I have in my work the creation of a seminar on the Dalits, who are today, and for 3,500 years, have been enslaved in India as the impoverished people of that country. So we have Socrates, Caesar, Jesus, and then we can move on into the Middle Ages. We have Henry II saying, "Will no one rid me of this pesky priest?" And then two of his henchmen left, crossed over, and then assassinated Thomas à Becket, a political assassination because he was uncomfortable for the regime of Henry II. And you go on to Henry VIII, and we have Thomas More, who made him very uncomfortable. And so Thomas More had to be taken care of. So we move through history then more closer to the present time when we deal with a man called Lawrence, T.E. Lawrence. Now, Lawrence lived in a place called Clouds Hill in Dorset, and he tried to remain as anonymous as he could. But he's the one man in British history who affronted and embarrassed the King of England, who held his magnificent ribbon to decorate him after the First World War and turned his back on the king and refused to take it. Joined the tank corps ultimately, and then made up his mind that he was going back to the Middle East to deal with his beloved Arabs. But beyond that, Henry Williamson, the Scottish fascist author, brought to him a letter from Adolf Hitler, who invited him to go to Berchtesgaden, because Hitler had identified Lawrence as the one man whom the British would accept as a dictator, because he was such a national hero. So Lawrence became intolerable to the realm, and he had to be eliminated. Another political assassination, because MI5 hit him with a black Mariah after he had sent a telegram to Williamson saying, come on up for tea on Tuesday. So there goes Lawrence of Arabia, as he was called by Lowell Thomas, and as we came to know him, and he was finished. So these are examples of political assassinations that one has to keep very clearly in mind, because I've come to believe that political assassination is the last resort. If they can get rid of you one way or another, diminish you, de-emphasize your work, they'll do that. Scandals, arrests, whatever, they will do that. But if they can't get rid of you that way, and you insist on challenging and become a serious threat to whatever power structure there is, then that's where assassination comes in. I'm about to turn in the later years now to what happened to Mr. Roosevelt. And I won't go into detail here, but what I have learned is staggering in terms of what really happened to Mr. Roosevelt at Warm Springs. Roosevelt had a plan of action to implement after the Second World War at the end of his days. He could not be allowed to implement that plan because it would have resulted in the indictments of Allen Dulles, John Foster Dulles, John McCloy. Go down the list of the henchmen of the forces that ruled this country. And Roosevelt was going after all of them. 30 Rockefeller Plaza, where Allen Dulles was given his rooms to work, Bill Stevenson had him wired and the entire floor wired. And they knew that Dulles, as Arthur Goldberg has said, the Dulles brothers were serious traitors and should have been tried. And Mr. Roosevelt was going after them. So we have those kinds of situations that have emerged throughout history. So without dwelling on it, I just want you to all understand that I firmly believe that, and has been, this historical use of political assassination throughout human society, and that we shouldn't be surprised with what happened in this country in the 1960s, which my colleagues are going to talk to you about. I thought when Martin was killed in 1968, they got the right guy. And they traced him, they arrested him, they tried him. I thought they got the right guy. That was 1968. I had known him only from 1967 when I came back from Vietnam as a journalist, and Ramparts published this article of mine called The Children of Vietnam. Martin was a subscriber to Ramparts. He asked to meet with me. He wept when he saw the photographs. He wept when he saw what his government was doing. That was in February of 1967. And on April 4th of 1967, he delivered his famous speech at Riverside Church, where he came out hard against the war. He then, at that point, said to me, can you stay with me and help develop a new politics movement? Which I agreed. And we had a convention in Chicago with over 5,000 delegates, and we were going to launch the King's Spot ticket, which I first asked masses of people in front of the UN to consider on April 15th, 1967, 11 days after Martin delivered his speech there. How naive we were. I look back and it's almost laughable at how stupid we were, because we didn't realize the extent to which the government would infiltrate and subvert and destroy a movement. So when the Black Caucus was founded at that convention in Chicago, and Martin was delivering the opening address, the keynote speech, a note gets passed to me over my shoulder, get him out of here, or we will take him hostage and embarrass him before the world. They had to get rid of him from that convention because he was a unifier. They had to finish him. So we had to get him out, told Andy, we have to get him out of here in order to avoid that kind of brutal embarrassment that was being led by the Blackstone Rangers, the Chicago gang. How naive we were. So out he goes, and then that same caucus starts introducing resolutions that split the movement terribly and made sure that there would not be any effective political opposition to Lyndon Johnson. So that went on and on. And eventually, Martin decided he was going to bring 500,000 people to Washington, not to march, but to camp and to visit the Congress, their congresspeople, and try to get put back into the budget monies that were taken out of the social programs because the war needed those monies. And the military knew that he might lose control of that because they weren't going to get that money back. And there was going to be mounting frustration, and that could lead to the same type of revolutionary turmoil that the world saw in Paris not so long before that. Lyndon Johnson didn't have André Malraux, who was able to deal with de Gaulle and to co-opt that movement. But Lyndon was going to rely on the military and the police to suppress it. But they didn't have the troops. Westmoreland wanted 200,000 more. They didn't have the troops for that. They didn't have the troops to put down what they saw was going to be a serious revolution on the streets of Washington. So Martin King was assassinated because he opposed the war in Vietnam, but was hitting the bottom lines of a number of American corporations, and two, because he was going to bring this mass of humanity to Washington, and that could lead to the revolution. So they made up their minds early on that he had to go. So what did they do? They profiled the Missouri State Penitentiary System, Hoover's request, and they found an ideal patsy, guy who was a con man. He was a convicted criminal who could be manipulated and controlled and used and moved around. And that, of course, was James Earl Ray. So they took James and they used him as the patsy. He escaped a little more than a year before the actual assassination. They moved him around the country. Martin was originally to have been killed in Los Angeles. They kept James in Los Angeles for a long time. The two military special ops guys who were the backup team could not kill him, but were the backup team, were also housed in Los Angeles for the fateful day. The problem was, as I came to realize in later years, there was another assassination going to take place in California a couple of months after Martin, and that was, of course, the assassination of Bob Kennedy. It wouldn't do to have two of those take place in the same city. So they switched around. The military guys didn't know why they were ordered to move to New Orleans and Memphis, but they were. James was moved to New Orleans and then eventually into Memphis. And Memphis, under Frank Holloman as director of police and fire, was where the assassination of Martin King was to take place. Whereas Lon was cleared for Bob to be hit in Los Angeles when he was, as expected, he would win the Los Angeles primary. So they set that stage very well. They gave Ray credentials. They gave him a handler. The name of the handler is a fellow called Raul. People said, oh, Raul, oh, he made this guy up. Raul was made up. Raul was a real guy. He was an operative who came out of Portugal. He worked for Portuguese intelligence in Angola. He was brought into the United States. He was given a job. He did their bidding. I was eventually able to find witnesses who knew Raul. I located where he lived. He lived in Yonkers, New York, would you believe? His name was Raul Coelho. Fairly recently, not so long ago, he died. But Raul was the handler for James and moved him around, gave him money, told him what to do. So they set all of this up. And I thought, when Martin was killed, it was a lone nut. How naive, right? That's where I, my naivete stretches, I'm afraid. But I believe that they had the right guy when they got him. And I just walked away. We buried Martin. Ben Spock and I went down to Atlanta. We buried Martin. Bobby asked me to come up and to his suite and talk about handling or working on his presidential campaign. And I said, no, I was through. Finished with politics. That was it for me. I walked away. 9 years later, Abernathy and I, who talked regularly over the years, and Abernathy said, look, I'd like you to go to the prison with me and interrogate Ray. And I said, what are you, come around the bend? He said, no. I said, do you think there's any reason why he might? He said, I don't know, but I'd like you to go. I have some uneasiness. And I didn't understand what was behind Ralph's request at that time. That's further naivete on my part. Ralph was diminishing his position in SCLC, and this was perhaps a chance for him to refurbish his own image. So I said, okay, but I don't know anything about the case. It took me 6 months to prepare. Finally, in 78, in August, we went up to the prison. I interrogated James for 5 hours with Jim Lawson and Mark Lane, who was representing James at the time, and Ralph was there. So we finished that five-hour session with a firm belief that James was not the shooter. I didn't know what role he might have played knowingly. Anyway, he wasn't the shooter. But he raised enough questions that I started in 1978, all those years ago, right? 1978, going into Memphis, quietly, on the streets, in the bars, talking to people who knew things that went on there. and more I learned, more and more questions became answered and new questions arose. And I would go visit James in prison, and he kept asking me to represent him. Mark took it as far as he could, and he left. So I said, no, I won't represent you until I'm sure you had nothing to do with this killing at all. That took 10 years, 78 to 88. Finally, I became convinced that this guy really was a patsy. Everything about him was that. So I took him on in 1988 as a client. We went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, having lost at the Federal District Court, went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then to the Supreme Court for cert. We lost everything. We didn't have a shot at winning at all. I worked on it. I got Thames Television because I had moved to England. I moved my young family to England in 1981 because I was tired of having my four-year-old son pick up the phone and hearing threats on his father's life and asking me who those guys were on the beach and who were those two guys over there in the duck blind on the other side of the road who every time I left, somehow their binoculars hit the sun and they were following me. This is no way to raise little kids. So I left and I went to England in 81. I became a visiting scholar at the Wilson College, Cambridge, and I kept commuting. And they had basically a peaceful life over there. I raised that first family in England. I lived there for 20 years. But the more I came back and the more I learned, the more it became evident to me that James Earl Ray was totally innocent of this crime and that somebody else was very much involved in the crime. So I did the first book in 1995, Orders to Kill, and that put forth everything that we learned up to the point of 1995, which meant the television trial that lasted for 10 days. Hickman Ewing was the prosecutor, unscripted trial, jury chosen from all over the country. It took them 7.5 hours to find Ray not guilty. I thought Hickman was going to have a heart attack. This is unheard of, right? And we had a smattering of the evidence that we eventually got, but was not guilty. Then the doors opened and more evidence and people came forth and the evidence picked up and led to James Earl Ray being met by the King family, by Dexter King. King family then coming out full-blown publicly asking for a trial for James Earl Ray. He died in 1988 in prison. We failed to get him a trial. 1999, we brought an actual civil action went on in Memphis for 30 days, 70 witnesses that clearly up to 2003 set all the information up as to how Martin King was killed, what we knew at that point in time. It was devastating stuff. Mainstream media, of course, woefully ignores all of this. They would come in when Coretta was testifying or Dexter or Andy Young, and then they would leave when the heavy evidence and witnesses started to appear. They would just go. Court TV was nowhere to be found, although they were going to televise it, but they were nowhere to be found. It was not reported, not devastated. It took the jury 59 minutes after 30 days and 70 witnesses. Took them 59 minutes to find that Martin King was killed by a conspiracy involving agents of the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, and the city of Memphis. And, of course, a low-level guy whom we sued called Lloyd Jowers, who owned the grill behind which Martin was killed. And it was Jowers who took the rifle from the shooter and brought it in and broke it down in front of his lover, who finally, 30 years later, finally admitted to me exactly what had happened. And the reason she was quiet all those years, because she thought Jowers himself had been the shooter. But Jowers was the main defendant. That gave us the basis for that lawsuit. You see. Okay. So I ran that story in a book called Act of State, An Act of State. That was published in 2003. And this is that book. And it put forward all of the evidence of the trial. The court reporter also put out a book called The 13th Juror. One of your colleagues here has that book. That has the whole transcript of the trial. Every bit of evidence in the trial was there. So that was 2003, right? So here we go from 1978 to 2003, and we have an enormous amount of information about how Martin King was killed. And I would have thought that's enough, but it wasn't enough, because all of a sudden, people are getting close to the grave. And if you write a book on these cases, and you do it in 3 or 4 years, and you get it out and you sell it, you maybe make some money with some of the bravado, you may be doing a service. But if you somehow hang on to a case for 30 years or 35 years, and in this case, really, it's 38 years, and you're there, and you keep going in and out of Memphis, and you know people who've never talked to you before, but all of a sudden are getting close to dying, and they now have something to say, then more and more evidence comes out. And more evidence comes out when the son of a Dixie Mafia operative who was responsible for bringing the money in from Hoover and dispensing these funds to local people, including people like the Reverend William Samuel Billy Kiles, who died recently, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who's still alive, because of services they will perform for the money. And here you have this young boy. He was 8, 9, and he's there and is seeing Clyde Tolson. How many of you know who Clyde Tolson was? Huh? Clyde Tolson was the guy whom, as you know, Hoover's number two, Hoover's lover, Hoover's trusted confidant. It was Tolson who was the guy who came all in and out, bringing the money, working with Frank Holloman, setting everything up. So here comes these new witnesses, this new Dixie Mafia family, and the head of the family died, and now the son is that much older, and he wants to get this off his chest. So he comes to me, and he tells me what happened. From his standpoint, he has a particular piece of information. He knows what happened, because he rode with his father to the prison carrying $25,000 to the warden of the prison to organize James Earl Ray's escape after James had been profiled. And he was there, his father. And he sat in. He brought the donuts and the coffee, and he sat in. He saw all these things, and he remembered them. And he was down on Mulberry Street on a bike when Martin was shot, and Earl Clark, who was a lieutenant in the Memphis Police Department, came down over the wall and ran up the street to get into a waiting police car to take him away. But Earl Clark was not the killer of Martin King. He was the spotter, and he was there doing his job as a spotter. The killer of Martin King was the best shot on the Memphis Police Department. He was paid a fairly small amount of money. He was an ex-Vietnam vet. Brother was killed in Vietnam. He hated black people. He behaved abysmally in terms of black people in the south side of Memphis. And he was readily recruited. And I had eyewitnesses who saw him the day of the shooting practicing early morning until he left around 3 o'clock at the Memphis Armory Police Department shooting range. And he left in his buddy's car, put the rifle on the back seat, which was described to my eyewitness, who was a custodian, black custodian, as a very special gun. Off he went. And he was the guy who shot Martin King. I had lunch with him. I asked him to have lunch with me. He needs money. So he agreed to have lunch with me. For $500. I paid him $500 and we had lunch. He wouldn't eat. And he sat there. And I said, you know, I have some witnesses who say you were the shooter. This is what you did. You killed Martin King. What do you have to say to that? And he said, I don't have anything to say to that. I said, well, you know, we got 2 plaster of Paris footprints where the shooter ran back toward an alleyway. It had rained the night before. And they got these footprints. And the size of those footprints, size 13. Now tell me, Frank, what size shoe do you wear? He said, 13 large. And he had a little grin on his face. But that's as far as I got in terms of getting out of him. However, I knew another taxi driver for years, 25 years. And I said, I want you, you know, Frank, you know who he is. He said, yeah, drives a taxi. He said, oh, yeah. Okay, I want you to just get in and confront him. See what he says. Guy got in the back of his car one day and said, hey, I hear they're going to get you. I hear you're going to be indicted. Pepper's got enough evidence on you to get you. And he said, what are they going to get me for? Something I did 30 years ago. I just blurted this out. Something I did 30 years ago. I said, oh, my goodness. So of course, we got an affidavit statement of that. But he's free. He's walking around. He still needs money. They only paid him $5,000 for the hit on Martin King. But that, in those days, seemed to be a lot of money, and he was happy to get it. So That it takes us up to a point, and I can't go really much beyond that point because that's in the third book, the final book in the trilogy, which will be out on June 7th. And that book culminates in the most depressing news of all that I have, because Martin King was not killed by that bullet that he took in the head. And I can't tell you any more than that, except I have the eyewitness details of how he actually died. And that is perhaps the most depressing part of my story with respect to Martin King's death. I don't want to go into that at this point in time. So that's as much as I can tell you, one, about the history of assassinations. Political assassinations are as virtually as old as human society. All the ones we had in the 60s were part and parcel. The difference is that the cover-ups that have taken place with respect to the assassination of Martin King, and of course John Kennedy and Bob Kennedy, and I am today Sirhan's lawyer. I took on Sirhan only when I became convinced, again, that he was a patsy. And I have to tell you that the evidence against him is so much less convincing. What's happened to Sirhan is the end of the Sixth Amendment in the United States, as far as I'm concerned. We have just lost at the Ninth Circuit. We're going to the Supreme Court. But it's clear he's a political prisoner. His own lawyer was under a pending indictment and threw the case entirely. Grant Cooper threw the case, collaborated with the prosecution, made sure that Sirhan would be convicted. The difference is that Sirhan, though profiled like Ray was also subjected to mind control. And we believe we know where that took place and even who did that and how he was subjected. And that's why he has this gap. Every parole hearing I've been at with Sirhan, I've been his counsel for the last two parole hearings. He honestly does not remember a period of time after he was pinched by his handler on the neck. He doesn't remember what happened after that. But we've been able to find 12 witnesses who always saw him in front of Bob. And of course, Bobby was hit with bullets fired at powder burn range from behind, by someone kneeling down behind him. So there's no question that Sirhan did not kill Bobby. But the cover-up is there. So we had these attempts to cover up, but nothing as sophisticated as we have seen with respect to the assassinations of the 60s. I've not been involved in the John Kennedy one. I deliberately stayed away from that one. I stayed away from Malcolm, although I know the family. Stayed away from it, would not get involved, because the more you get involved in these cases, one, the more it impoverishes you personally, because there's no money to pay for any of this. And also, the more you get maligned and attacked as a conspiracy nut, no matter how much the facts are there and back you up, you get maligned as a conspiracy nut. So it's better to focus on a limited number of them. I'm sorry to say. It takes others like colleagues here and others whom you know, like Jim Douglas and people like that, who will carry forward work on the other cases. But have no illusions. Political assassination is well in the history of mankind, and you can expect more of these in the future. I spent a lot of time in Latin South America. You all know, or many of you may know, the history of Salvador Allende, Archbishop Romero. And I have to tell you, Hugo Chavez was like a brother to me. I was very close to Hugo. And I have a lot of information about how Hugo got his cancer that killed him after 18 months. And I desperately tried to get Hugo away from the Spanish doctors who came to Cuba and get him into another situation. But he was convinced that the Spanish doctors were going to take care of him. So we had chemotherapy and the radiation, which is associated with cancer treatments generally and known to fail. And of course, it failed and Hugo died. So we've had our share in this hemisphere of assassinations. They will continue, and you only can expect nothing else from a power structure that wants to control the world.
And again, you've just been listening to a speech given by Dr. William Pepper at the Left Forum in May of 2016. I highly recommend that you get a copy of his new book, The Plot to Kill King. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Now,
members of Congress must reject confirmation of Senator Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions as U.S. Attorney General. As a known racist with a long record of opposing civil rights and equality, it is unimaginable that Sessions could be entrusted to serve as the nation's top law enforcement official. Now, leading the charge against Sessions has been the NAACP, whose members recently sat in his Mobile, Alabama office to protest the nomination, which ended when six people, including NAACP President Cornell Brooks, were arrested and face now criminal trespass charges. And we're joined by Devin Crawford, co-chair of the Alchemy in Color and a student at the University of Chicago Divinity School. Devin is the 2016 NAACP Humanity in Action Fellow and has been conducting policy research and advocacy at the NAACP's Baltimore headquarters and was one of the six arrested occupying the office of Alabama's Senator Jeffrey Sessions and grew up himself in Alabama.
Thank you for having me.
Well, why don't we start from yesterday, your experience. I know that you were there in protest at the hearings that were held on Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions. Why don't you tell us what happened and then work towards building the case that caused you also to be arrested against the confirmation as U.S. Attorney General of Jeff Sessions?
Thank you. I think yesterday represents some of the best traditions that we have in this country of dissent and civil disobedience. We were joined by five students from Howard University, two staff members from an advocacy organization called Democracy Spring, along with myself and Anthony Davis, who is the national coordinator for the NAACP Youth and College Division. All of us converged on the Russell Senate Office Building to conduct a nonviolent direct action of sit-in, and Congress and Senator Jeff Sessions, Senate office, which was literally down the hall from the caucus room where the Judiciary Committee was conducting his confirmation hearing. And the message was loud and clear. It was done in the same tradition as the Atlanta Student Movement, as the Birmingham Children's Movement of the 60s, where young people were raising their voices and making their opinions known that we will not allow a known racist, bigot, to occupy the highest law office in this land. Too much is at stake when it comes to voting rights, when it comes to criminal justice reform and immigration reform, to the point that we need a competent and a courageous attorney general, not one who continues to play dog whistle politics and who harkens us back to a bygone era of racial bias and bigotry.
Devin, Sessions himself is trying to soften his image at this point. And liberal media is also saying, well, you know, some of the comments that were most offensive were made some years back, and words can't kill. It's just opinion differences. But he certainly would suddenly become an objective purveyor of his responsibility as what the top law enforcement official should be. How do you understand, and how do you respond to that? I mean, I'm kind of tempted to say the leopard doesn't change their spots, but your own thoughts on this.
Right. Well, you know, as a Christian minister, I fully believe in the changing of hearts and transformation. But as a U.S. citizen, particularly as a young black man, we have to come to terms with the facts of this case. And the facts are that leading up to this moment, Jeffrey Sessions, possibly in word, but certainly not in deed, has not proven his commitment to human or civil rights, being one of the foremost opponents of immigration legislation, He has not opted in to any of the bipartisan measures for criminal justice reform. So for us to have some type of belief that he's had an epiphany since his nomination, and along with, I have to note that he has been an ardent supporter of our president-elect, who has also propagated the same vitriolic language in the public square. So it would be nice to believe that there has been some type of changing of hearts and minds, but the records do not reflect such. So we have to move forward accordingly, and that is to push for the withdrawal of Senator Sessions and also to lift up nominees that are reflective of the current progressive movement in this country, who recognize that America, our legal system and our foundations of justice must only widen and broaden and not restrict themselves due to partisan politics. And so that's my response to that. It would be great to believe that there has been some radical change, but the record does not reflect.
I'm wondering also how your growing up in Alabama may have informed your now conviction that Sessions isn't fit to be confirmed for the nation's top law enforcement job. And I know that you've been kind of traversing the country recently. You've been involved in the demonstrations, I believe, in Chicago around the death by the police of Laquan McDonald. How do these issues inform your positioning on Jeffrey Sessions?
Yes, well, growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, I was surrounded by the history of courageous dissent of not only students or outside activists, but also by ministers of the church. The church, the Black church particularly, has been the most long-standing institution in Black communities. And it is incumbent upon all ministers who proclaim a gospel of Jesus, who was a poor, radical zealot, pushing for issues that concern the poor, it is important for us to model that same ministry. So when I moved to Atlanta for undergraduate studies, there were several cases, whether it was from Troy Davis or Michael Brown, that, you know, I felt compelled to work with other students to organize around, whether it was in Chicago with the death of Laquan McDonald and the public unrest that surrounded that. It's important that the church, being one of the main institutions that our public invests itself in, to have a clarion voice for prophetic resistance and moral courage, and to inspire those who have a will to do but who may not have the direction. So I take much of my models of leadership from those like the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks, from Henry McNeil Turner, from, you know, a gambit of leaders who were critical of the issues of their time, but they were also able to project the prophetic hope that in spite of the darkness of our time, we must not fall into despair, but always push for a greater light that can overcome the darkness.
Now, one of the things that I wonder if you can address the issue of the NAACP, the question of Sessions' response or the issues of championing voter suppression, frankly, his issues as an opponent of legal immigration, his responses to issues of women and pay equity. I mean, all of these are part of what is under the rubric of U.S. Attorney General. Your thoughts?
Yes. I have to say that Jeff Sessions, it's really not a matter of character or being a decent human, but again, we're looking at the record. Note this, that Jeff Sessions has called the Voting Rights Act of 1965 intrusive legislation. He has gone on to endorse hate groups like the KKK, and at this critical time of our nation's history, when we have particularly in the state of Alabama, where 500,000 men and women were blocked from the polls because they were they had criminal records or because a DMV in their area was closed down, so they were not able to have access to the proper IDs. This is the type of systemic suppression that has been at best silently and at worst explicitly endorsed by Jeff Sessions. We need a moral revolution in which we can look at these issues of the day and figure out how we can support the most vulnerable instead of scapegoating them and finding ways to demonize and dehumanize them in order to lift up, I guess, a false notion of what it means to be an American. And Jeff Sessions has not proven his capacity to do such.
Devin Crawford, let's go back to yesterday. Was it your feeling that the protests were sufficient or robust enough that enough people who have joined in the call with organizations like the NAACP, who, as I said, has very much been taking the lead to assure that Jeff Sessions, Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions, who was named after, and proudly so, the Confederate presidency of and guards that name carefully, which is telling. Is it your sense that the protests were substantive enough to have an impact on the senators who will be voting on the nomination for Jeff Sessions as the chief law enforcement agent of this country?
I do believe it has had an effect. We have heard that Senator Cory Booker is breaking a long precedent in the Senate by testifying against his colleague. First time it's ever happened in a confirmation hearing for this office. We've not heard explicitly from all senators or from all congresspersons, but we have heard from their constituents who have been inspired by these actions, who are taking the risk of sitting in, some who are just conducting walk-ins that are delivering their demands to the offices of their respective congresspersons or senators. We've had people who wrote in, who've written in, who've called in. So we haven't been able to judge or assess accurately the expanse of the impact on elected officials, but we certainly know that their constituents are, they're awake, they're alert, and they are also making their voices heard in the thousands across this country. So that gives us great hope, because after Jeff Sessions, there are also several other battles that we have to fight, and it's important that we have as diverse and as broad a coalition across this country as possible help us in those battles. It may be more confirmation hearings for cabinet officials. It may be policy that is intrusive and invasive, that that erodes the human and civil rights of our citizens. So I think it's important that we continue to build, that we continue to enroll people in this fight for justice, and that they find ways that they can all give of their time and talent to push forward the movement that's been building in this country, particularly among millennials, who are some of the most savvy users of technology today.
So we're dealing with a man who has a long history of opposing civil rights enforcement, making racist comments, including about the his support for the Ku Klux Klan. He's championed voter suppression. He opposes hate crime legislation, and that was very much around the opposition to the terrifying crime against Matthew Shepard, a young gay man who was tortured to death, and the hate crime legislation that grew out of it. He's opposed multiple efforts to address pay equity for women. He's a staunch opponent of legal immigration. And again, people like Devin Crawford and the NAACP, Code Pink was there yesterday, have been leading the charge to prevent Senator Sessions from becoming the chief law enforcement officer. I want to give you the final opportunity as they say, la luta continua, the struggle does continue in any event. The issues of diversity, the issues of equality, the issues of compassion, and a young, dejected and hurt African-American community of youth. Where do you see the struggle, or what Reverend Barbara would call the third reconstruction, going from here in any event?
Thank you. I think that at the base of our struggles across this country is really a recognition of the common humanity that all people share, irrespective of their station or class or nation of origin. We all share a common humanity, and it is incumbent upon all of us to support and to provide what is necessary for that humanity to thrive. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Has eloquently stated that we are all tied in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied together in a garment of destiny. I cannot be what I ought to be unless you are what you ought to be. And that fundamental recognition that our basic humanity is tied together, wed together, and we cannot move forward, Black, white, Latina, Chinese, Asian, we cannot move forward unless we move together as brothers and sisters. We can go fast if we go alone, but we cannot go far if we go unless we go together. So I think that the new Reconstruction calls upon us to move beyond the artificial boundaries of race and class and station, and to find ways that we can support the educational, social, political, and economic striving of all Americans. And that's really at the base of the work of the NAACP. That's at the base of the work of organizations like the ACLU and other partner organizations, Humanity in Action, and a younger generation that is coming into its own and that is taking history by its own reins, is recognizing that and moving beyond the biases of a bygone age. So I'm hopeful. We have some very dark and trying times ahead of us, but our resolve has not been stronger, and that will only propel us into unseen or unforeseen possibilities as a millennial generation.
Devin Crawford, with people such as yourself, we will absolutely make it so. And in the words of U.S. Representative Luis Gutierrez, if you have nostalgia for the days when Blacks kept quiet, gays were in the closet, immigrants were invisible, and women stayed in the kitchen, Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions is your man. Well, he sure isn't ours. Devin Crawford, thank you for joining us. And all of us, take this time, make sure that your senators know that we do not accept the confirmation of Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions as U.S. Attorney General. Devin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We shall not, be moved.
Just like Sweet Honey in the Rock, we shall not be moved.
And now Cornell Brooks, president and CEO of the NAACP, gives his opening remarks before the Senate Judiciary Committee during the nomination hearings of Jeffrey Sessions.
Chairman Grassley, Ranking Member Whitehouse, and esteemed senators of this committee, my name is Cornell William Brooks. I serve as president and CEO of the NAACP. I greatly appreciate the invitation to testify before you today and to express the deep concerns of the NAACP regarding the nomination of Senator Jefferson Sessions to be U.S. Attorney General. As you well know, the Attorney General is the Chief Law Enforcement Officer of the United States. Particularly for such a time as this, with racial divisions deepening, hate crimes rising from sanctuaries to schoolyards, with state-imposed, racially motivated voter suppression spreading in state legislatures, as well as being struck down in federal courts, with police-involved shootings reduced to hashtag homicides and viralized videos. It is critical that this committee closely examine Senator Sessions' entire record as a prosecutor and as a legislator to determine whether he is fit to serve as the chief enforcer of our nation's civil rights laws. Based upon a review of the record, the NAACP firmly believes that Senator Sessions is unfit to serve as Attorney General. Accordingly, we representing multiple civil rights and human rights coalitions, we urge this committee not to favorably report his nomination to the full Senate. As our written testimony details, Senator Sessions' record reveals a consistent disregard for civil and human rights of vulnerable populations, including African Americans, Latinos, women, Muslims, immigrants, the disabled, the LGBT community, and others. Further, his Senate voting record reflects a fundamental disregard for many of the Department of Justice's programs, which are vital for the protection of Americans. Senator Sessions' votes against the Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2000, 2002, 2004, 2007, and 2009, and the Violence Against Women Act in 2012 and 2013 demonstrate a disturbing lack of concern regarding violent crimes, rape, assault, murder committed against minorities and an American majority, women. These crimes in particular make victims of individuals as well as the groups to which they belong and the American values we cling to. His opposition to the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act indicates a hostility to the claims of employment discrimination and more specifically to allowing legal redress for pay discrimination against women. His consistent opposition to any meaningful gun control shows an unwillingness to stand up to the firearms lobby and a lack of concern regarding the destructive impact of gun violence on our children and communities. His failure to condemn the president-elect's call for an unconscionable and unconstitutional ban on Muslim immigrants, as well as his opposition to a Senate resolution condemning a government-imposed litmus test on a global religion, evidences an unwillingness to protect the rights of the vulnerable and the unpopular, which is something an attorney general must do. His call for the reevaluation of a basic constitutional principle that persons born in this country are citizens of this country reflects a form of an unconstitutional xenophobia that is fundamentally inconsistent with the duty of the Attorney General to protect the rights of all Americans. His calling into question the legitimacy of consent decrees causes us to question whether he will use this powerful tool to hold accountable police departments such as Ferguson that engaged in predatory policing and a pattern and practice of discrimination. With his consistent support for mandatory minimums as a prosecutor and a legislator, he stands in opposition to bipartisan efforts to bring to an end this ugly era of mass incarceration, with 2.3 million Americans behind bars, with overpopulated prisons and jails, and depopulated families and communities. It is Senator Sessions' record on voting rights, however, that is perhaps the most troubling. As this committee is well aware of the infamous Marion III case in which civil rights activists were prosecuted by then U.S. Attorney Sessions for voter fraud, all of whom were acquitted by a jury in less than 4 hours on 29 counts. This chilling prosecution against innocent civil rights workers who were later given gold medals by Congress painfully reverberates in the hearts of black voters in Alabama and the history of this country. Senator Sessions' record of prosecuting so-called voter fraud and both intimidating and suppressing voters then is now reflected in a legislative record of supporting voter ID requirements that suppress votes based on the myth of voter fraud today. His record of vote-suppressing prosecution is connected to a vote-suppressing legislation today. Rather than condemn, he's commended voter ID laws like that in his own state of Alabama affecting a half million voters, similar to laws struck down in Texas and North Carolina in the Fourth and Fifth Circuits. If we can imagine a Senator Sessions leading a Department of Justice in Michael Brown's Ferguson, Freddie Gray's Baltimore, towns with rising hate crime, communities of vulnerable populations, and a democracy divided by voter suppression in its Twitter age civil rights movement. We can imagine that. Imagining that, we must face the reality that Senator Sessions should not be our Attorney General. With that said, thank you for this opportunity to testify. I welcome your questions.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
We are not a nation that says, don't ask, don't tell. We are a nation that says, out of many, we are one. While today marks the end of a particular struggle that has lasted almost two decades, this is a moment more than two centuries in the making.
And now it is my honor to sign this bill into law.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Taiwan moves to equalize civil marriage and ban the cure. North Carolina lawmakers double-cross Charlotte and keep their bathroom bill. And do remember Obama's repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBT communities around the world for the 3 weeks ending January 7th, 2017. Taiwan has taken two important steps to make life easier for the island's LGBTQ citizens. The first was the advance of a civil marriage equality bill, and the second was a move to outlaw so-called cure therapy for LGBTQ patients. Thousands of both supporters and opponents of marriage equality rallied in late December outside the nation's legislature, known as the Legislative Yuan, following initial committee approval of the bill to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. Supporters hoisted pro-equality banners and waved rainbow flags. Police arrested more than 100 anti-equality demonstrators when they attempted to break into the committee hearing. Opponents then moved to the presidential office to call for the resignation of Taiwan's pro-equality president, Tsai Ing-wen. A spokesperson for the protesters complained that a committee of 13 legislators should not decide how the nation defines family and marriage. The legislature's Judiciary and Organic Laws and Statutes Committee passed draft amendments to the Civil Code on December 26th that would give lesbian and gay couples the same marital, parental, and adoptive rights and obligations as heterosexual couples. According to the Taipei Times, the next legislative review is not expected until April.
Taiwan's Ministry of Health and Welfare greeted the new year with draft legislation to outlaw so-called reparative or change therapy that claims to make LGBTQ people straight. An increasing number of jurisdictions around the world have outlawed the debunked practice for patients under the age of 18. Taiwan's proposal appears to ban the practice for adults as well. Citizens can comment on the draft legislation until the end of January. After considering opinions expressed during the public consultation period, the ministry could publish the final regulations as early as March. They would be added to the island's Physicians Act and would punish any practitioner of so-called change therapy with fines and possible suspensions.
Meanwhile, Taipei has become the third city in Taiwan to allow same-gender couples to apply for partnership certificates, following Kaohsiung and Taichung. The island's biggest municipality began offering family care leave and the ability to consult on a partner's medical care to registered lesbian and gay couples in late December.
The largest city in Japan, Sapporo, became in late December the latest in that country to consider issuing formal recognition certificates to same-gender couples. The city of about 2 million people could join Iga and the Shibuya and Setagaya wards in Tokyo, which began issuing certificates to lesbian and gay couples in 2016. Officials in Sapporo say they hope to begin issuing their own recognition certificates by March 2018. Although public opinion polls show increasing support for civil marriage equality in the country, a majority of respondents in the most recent survey, Japan's federal government, refuses to legally recognize same-gender couples.
Even though one of its staunchest defenders, now former Governor Pat McCrory, is no longer in power, North Carolina's so-called bathroom bill, HB2, remains alive and well. That odious law not only denies trans people access to the public restrooms that match their gender identity, it bans local governments from enacting anti-discrimination protections for LGBT people. Passage of such an ordinance in Charlotte led the Republican-controlled state legislature to quickly enact HB2, a bill that McCrory enthusiastically signed. The Charlotte City Council understood that repeal of its ordinance was necessary before North Carolina lawmakers would consider repealing HB2. But after the city did that, the state legislature, still dominated by Republicans, failed to repeal HB2 in a special session called for that purpose on December 21st. Democratic Governor-elect Roy Cooper lamented the action, saying that it was our best chance to get this done, but vowing to continue pushing for repeal, it cannot be our only chance. Republican State Senator Buck Newton charged that Democrats only wanted a repeal in order to force radical social engineering and shared bathrooms across North Carolina at the expense of our state's families, our reputation, and our economy. He seemed oblivious to the hundreds of millions of dollars already lost to the state in boycotts and event cancellations because of HB2. The North Carolina law is being challenged as unconstitutional in federal court.
Texas Republicans also seem oblivious to the consequences of passing a similar law in the Lone Star State. The Texas Privacy Act was officially introduced on January 5th. It requires all state residents to use bathrooms, locker rooms, or other sex-segregated public facilities that match the gender on their birth certificates. It also prohibits local governments from passing ordinances that protect LGBT rights in public restrooms or other intimate settings. The Associated Press reports that the largest business lobbying group in Texas warns that passing the HB2 clone could cost the state up to $8.5 billion and more than 100,000 jobs.
But Virginia's Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe, this week issued an executive order banning state contracts with companies that discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. The January 5th edict applies to contracts entered into by the state's executive branch and would apply to such work as building roads and highways. It expands an order McAuliffe signed 3 years ago banning anti-LGBT bias in the state's workforce. McAuliffe also announced this week that he'll veto a Republican-sponsored bill to regulate bathroom use in Virginia if it reaches his desk.
Kansas became the fourth state in the union to make California's official no-fly list. The Attorney General recently added Kansas to the three other states with anti-queer laws, for which most taxpayer-funded state travel has been banned. Kansas joins Mississippi, North Carolina, and Tennessee. The Attorney General's office doesn't explain its reason for including the quartet of states on the travel ban on the main page of its website, but it includes links to the anti-LGBT laws each state has passed at the end of a separate page titled Frequently Asked Questions. The list could grow. In addition to Texas, anti-LGBT legislation is also being considered in Alabama, Georgia, Iowa, and West Virginia. According to the LGBT Washington Blade newspaper, eyes will also be on Iowa, Missouri, and Kentucky, where the November elections swept Republicans into control of both the legislative and executive branches.
A federal judge in Texas has gutted provisions in the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, that protect the health care rights of transgender people. U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor ruled that requiring medical practitioners to treat transgender patients violates the federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010 with an anti-discrimination clause designed to prevent insurers from charging customers more or denying coverage based on age or gender. The lawsuit challenging that part of the law was brought by Texas, Wisconsin, Kentucky, Nebraska, and Kansas, as well as the Christian Medical and Dental Association and the religious-affiliated Franciscan Alliance, a 14-hospital system operating in Indiana and Illinois. O'Connor's ruling comes just 4 months after he blocked an Obama administration directive in another lawsuit filed by many of those same states that required public schools to let transgender students use the bathrooms consistent with their gender identity.
Joe Maldonado, an 8-year-old transgender boy, was kicked out of his Cub Scouts pack in Secaucus, New Jersey, in late December after some parents complained to the Northern New Jersey Council of the Boy Scouts. His mother, Christy, told USA Today that it was no secret that Joe is transgender and that not one of the kids said you don't belong here. Joe himself said he was way more angry than sad. "My identity is a boy. If I was them, I would let every person in the world go in. It's right to do." Even though the Boy Scouts of America has lifted its ban on openly gay members or adult leaders, a spokeswoman said that membership by transgender scouts is a separate issue that has yet to be addressed by the organization.
But finally, a new school that opened in the port city of Kochi, in the Indian state of Kerala, at the end of December may be the first of its kind. Its focus is helping transgender adults from 25 to 50 who had dropped out of school complete their education. The residential school is headed by Vijay Raja Malika, who noted that Kerala has some 25,000 transgenders and 57% of them were forced to drop out of school due to stigma. Indian Supreme Court ruled in 2014 that the country's estimated 2 million transgender people have equal rights under the law. While the ruling allowed transgender people to marry, inherit property, and fill quotas in jobs and educational institutions, discrimination is still commonplace in the country's socially stratified population. Most Roman Catholic churches aren't generally considered to be welcoming places for LGBT people, despite Pope Francis's public statement urging compassionate pastoral care for sexual and gender minorities. But trans activist Malika is with the Sisters of the Congregation of Mother Carmel. She said her organization, which hopes to expand beyond its current 10-student capacity, includes Roman Catholic priests, nuns, and laypeople.
That's News Wrap for the 3 weeks ending January 7th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
We'll do an about-face to recall the liberation of the U.S. military. But first...
We got long stories.
Short stories.
Art stories.
Sports stories.
Books about the wild, wild west.
Yeehaw! We got fairy tales.
Scary tales.
We've even got some hairy tales.
It's hard to choose which ones are best.
So hard!
We got silly books.
Sad books.
Good books.
Bad books.
They're all great in their way. But whichever...
Queer Life and Literature commentator Janet Mason fires up the time machine with The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism by Adrienne Brooks, and Literary Philadelphia by Tom Nichols.
I've seen a lot of history, especially in the LGBTQ movement. But even so, I find it helpful to have a refresher now and then. This is particularly true with LGBTQ history, which, sadly to say, has been erased with a few notable exceptions. Knowing your history is necessary, but reading about it can also be enjoyable. In The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism by Adrienne Brooks, Cleese Press, which is put together as a collection of lively essays, many by well-known LGBTQ activists, writers, and public figures, including Barney Frank, I learned more than a few things. I was particularly taken with New York Times best-selling author Patricia Nell Warren's essay on Bayard Rustin. Rustin spoke out about gay rights in the 1940s, and he went on to become a major civil rights activist and Dr. Martin Luther King's right-hand man. Warren gets to the heart of why history is important when she writes about teaching LGBTQ students of color in Los Angeles who were hungry to know that they had some towering historical role models like Rustin. In Literary Philadelphia, The History Press by Tom Nichols, I particularly enjoy the insights that Nichols, a gay writer and activist, provides. This includes a mention of Walt Whitman. The bearded poet was a familiar sight on Market Street, along with lesser-known gay writers and non-LGBT Philadelphia literati, such as James Mitchell and Pearl S. Buck. In the chapter called Poetadelphia, he writes about poet Jim Corey and quotes him extensively about his stumbling across the mentor book of major American poets. It was sacred text. It explains everything. I still have it. 5 years later, it was all about the Beats and Bohemian Rebellion. Fast forward 10 years, and a lot of what I was writing was gay poetry. In my 60s, I write in different voices to satisfy different ends. Short poems appeal because of the challenge of getting something complicated into 7 lines, cut-ups, and collage, because they're fun and with any luck can be fun for the reader, too. Jim and I were part of a poetry collective that he founded in the early to mid-90s, called Inside to Riot Press. In this same chapter, I was surprised to come across a photo of myself, Jim Corey, and poet C.A. Conrad, also an Inside to Riot collective member, taken in 1994. We all look much younger. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
You're listening to This Way Out, brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Donald Trump.
As an African American, as an openly gay man, and as an American, that frightens me.
Not our president! Not our president!
I hate to say that Donald Trump unified us in that way.
Whatever it takes.
Our latest CD special, Trump Trauma and the Dawn of the Donald, is hot off the presses and available now at thiswayout.org. President Barack Obama bid farewell to the U.S. military at a joint armed forces ceremony this week, where he said that the full inclusion of women and LGBT people made the military stronger now than it was when he took office. The repeal of the Clinton administration's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in December 2010 drew a chorus of hail to the chief from queer service members, in particular one Army Lieutenant Dan Choi, who a year earlier became the poster soldier for repeal when he dared to come out on MSNBC's The Rachel Maddow Show.
Another U.S. president, another gay man, and a U.S. senator were the latest to make history late last month. We'll hear in a few minutes about a very literal exchange between Lieutenant Dan Choi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and why Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts could be called clean and articulate. But let's start with President Barack Obama's December 22nd foray into the textbooks, the day he signed legislation to authorize repeal of the U.S. military's odious Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Free Speech Radio News reporter Danny Wood covered the celebratory ceremony.
We are not a nation that says, don't ask, don't tell. We are a nation that says, out of many, we are one. We are a nation that welcomes the service of every patriot. We are a nation that believes that all men and women are created equal. Those are the ideals that generations have fought for. Those are the ideals that we uphold today, and now it is my honor to sign this bill into law.
Repealing the 17-year-old Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was one of Obama's campaign promises. Before the celebratory crowd, Obama thanked the many people who fought long and hard to reach this day, including military members who've been discriminated against throughout U.S. history.
Finally, I want to speak directly to the gay men and women currently serving in our military. For a long time, your service has demanded a particular kind of sacrifice. You've been asked to carry the added burden of secrecy and isolation, and all the while you've put your lives on the line for the freedoms and privileges of citizenship that are not fully granted to you. You're not the first to have carried this burden. For while today marks the end of a particular struggle that has lasted almost two decades, this is a moment more than two centuries in the making. There will never be a full accounting of the heroism demonstrated by gay Americans in service to this country. Their service has been obscured in history, been lost to prejudices that have waned in our own lifetimes. But at every turn, at every crossroads in our past, we know gay Americans fought just as hard, gave just as much to protect this nation and the ideals for which it stands.
The president said officials will implement the repeal swiftly and efficiently. To find out more about the transition, we go to Aaron Tax, legal director with Service Members Legal Defense Network. He was at the signing ceremony. Now, your legal group was founded when Don't Ask originally came into law in 1993, so today's repeal must be quite a day for you.
I think it's quite an accomplishment, and it really rests on the shoulders of people who've been advocating and pushing for repeal for years and years and years, and even before the organization was founded, back to World War II when there was a regulatory ban on gay people serving in the military. So this victory has been a long time coming.
What was the key turning point in achieving the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
I think the day Congress finally caught up to the American people who, ever since 1993, have been increasingly supportive of open service. And I think, you know, if you have polls showing 80% of the American public supporting repeal, and you have the Pentagon Working Group study that showed 92% of folks in the military either know of someone in their unit to be gay or believe someone in their unit to be gay and had absolutely no problems with it. I think at some point, you know, the law has got to change, and that's what finally happened today.
What's the first step of the implementation process?
Well, the two key components of implementation are going to be leadership and training, and we're going to look to the military to provide leadership on this front and to provide the necessary training so that the military is going to be a welcoming place for those who wish to serve openly.
What do you see as some of the key hurdles to overcome?
I think at the end of the day, there aren't significant hurdles. I mean, I think there's going to have to be regulations that have to be tweaked. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think it's really going to be a non-event. And I think that's what we've seen based on the experiences of other countries who've had to face this very same situation. Many of our allies had bans on gay people serving, got rid of them. And the response was it really wasn't a big deal at the end of the day. And I think that's what we're going to find here. I think that's because, as the Pentagon study showed, when people know someone in their unit is gay or believe that person to be gay, they really, by and large, don't have a problem with it. It's easy to hate someone that you don't know. I think it's a lot different when you start to know that your battle buddy is gay and is someone who you've worked with for years and years and years and has your back.
Some anti-war and anti-poverty groups aren't as celebratory about today's repeal as you are and many others. Not from an equal rights point of view, but they say from the perspective that militarism and war profiteering don't serve the true interests of anyone, including gays and lesbians.
Well, I think at the end of the day, we have to look at service in the military as a fundamental part of what it means to be a citizen in this country. And when you don't have equal rights for those in the military, it's hard to have equal rights for anyone else in this country. We need an Employment Non-Discrimination Act to bar employment discrimination in the private sector and in the government sector when you have a law in the book that says gay people must be fired simply for being gay in the military. So I think this passage of this law will go a long way in furthering the rights of LGBT individuals all across the country.
Aaron Tax with Service Members Legal Defense Network, thanks very much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco.
MSNBC News commentator Rachel Maddow heralded the imminent demise of Don't Ask, Don't Tell that night with a live audience at New York City's 92nd Street Y.
It seems important to me that the president was freaking elated to sign the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal bill today. So that's one. That's thing one, the historic thing today. Thing two, the thing I can't quite believe happened, even though I know it did, is this. You may remember this happened in July at Netroots Nation, which is the big progressive conference that was held in Vegas this year. Check this out.
This morning, Dan Choi gave me this to give to you. That's his West Point ring. He says it doesn't mean what it did mean to him anymore. And this is his discharge.
He earned this ring, and I'm going to give it back to him. I don't need his ring to fulfill the promise that I made to him.
Thank you. When it's signed, Senator,
okay.
When it's signed.
That's good enough with me. When the bill's signed, I'll keep it safely and give it back to him. Okay? When we get it passed, you'll take it back, right?
I sure will, but I'm going to hold you accountable.
Okay, that's good.
So that was Dan Choi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. That took place in July. And then today, Senator Reid posts this on Twitter. I literally see it. Why I'm on Twitter wasting time. He posts this on Twitter 5 months after I promised to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I'm so happy to give this West Point ring to Lieutenant Dan Choi. And then, ta-da, link to this picture of Senator Reid giving Dan Choi back his West Point ring. It's such a fierce activist now, cast in flame, right? Here's how Dan Choi responded also on Twitter to that. He wrote this, quote, "The next time I get a ring from a man, I expect it to be for full equal American merit." Take that! All right, so that's thing number two. I said I had one other thing I wanted to show you. Thing three. This is not the historic thing. This is not OMG. I can't believe it. But this also happened, and I think it is important that I tell you that it happened. Behold, Congressman Barney Frank, Democrat of Massachusetts, and a reporter from a conservative news service called Cybercast.
I have a question for you about the working group that Secretary Gates put into effect. He appointed the Defense Department working group. They recommended that a straight military personnel will have to shower with homosexual openly.
Showering with homosexual? What do you think happens in gyms all of America? What do you think happens in the House of Representatives? Of course people shower with homosexuals. What a silly issue. What do you think goes wrong when people shower with homosexuals? Do you think it's the spray makes it catching? I mean, people shower with homosexuals in college dormitories, in gyms where people play sports, in gyms elsewhere. It is a complete non-issue.
So that recommendation, you think, is a non-issue?
To accept the principle that homosexuals can't shower with other people is a degree of discrimination that goes far beyond this. I mean, we don't get ourselves dry cleaned.
We don't get ourselves dry cleaned. Ta-da! Three things that, for various reasons, I'm glad I saw today. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is dead, and Barney Frank is still hilarious. I am so happy to know about the dry cleaning thing. I always felt like an outcast in the community, having never done that.
And that was MSNBC's Pressed to Perfection, Rachel Maddow.
I'm grateful for all that you've done to work with us to accomplish some amazing transformations over these last 7.5 years.
We say goodbye to the man who identifies himself as a fierce advocate for LGBT rights, U.S. President Barack Obama, next time on This Way Out. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Francis O'Brien, and Janet Mason contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Between the Lions performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. It's never too late to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Free Radio Santa Cruz, California, 2BLU, Katoomba, New South Wales, WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin, and on more than 200 local stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. I've seen what hate, and we all see what hate is doing to this whole sick country at this moment. America is a sick place, and man is on the critical list. Those words were spoken in 1970 by a dynamic and outspoken black radical named Fannie Lou Hamer. Radical also were the political thoughts and opinions of someone very different from Hamer, a white monk by the name of Thomas Merton, who had written a series of widely read modern spiritual classics. Both Merton and Hamer turned to politics in large part because of their religious convictions and understandings. Fannie Lou Hamer and Thomas Merton are two people who Albert Raboteau admires and writes about in his new book, American Prophets, Seven Religious Radicals and Their Struggle for Social and Political Justice. Albert Raboteau is a specialist in American religious history. He has taught at Yale, UC Berkeley, and Harvard, and he's currently the Henry W. Putnam Professor Emeritus of Religion at Princeton University. When he joined me from a studio at Princeton, I first brought up Fannie Lou Hamer, who was born in 1917 in rural Mississippi. Her parents were sharecroppers, and I asked Albert Raboteau what kind of poverty the young Hamer and her family lived in.
They lived in the poverty of the Delta area of Mississippi, which for black people for generations since slavery had been, to use the common term, dirt poor. They worked the cotton fields for white landowners. They lived in shacks without running water, without indoor toilets, and they had very little prospects in terms of upward mobility in their lives. And their labor was long, from sun up to dusk, and it was under the beating heat of Mississippi sun. Many of you have, your listeners have been to Mississippi in the summertime, you know how vibrant that heat is. Their only protections were battered straw hats and cloth head coverings. And she was one of 20 children. And her mother tried to make a go of things by feeding them greens with a little bit of gravy. And her father, who was a minister, tried to raise a little extra money by selling bootleg liquor. So they were among the poorest of the poor.
What did Hamer think about the family's poverty in the context of how hard they and other blacks worked?
Well, very early on, she realized that white people weren't working nearly as hard as she and her family were. And she also realized that white people had a lot more goods, tractors, horses. And she asked her mother one day, why did God make us black? Wouldn't it have been better to be white? And her mother said, God made you black because he wanted you to be black. And never look at other people as better than you. You are exactly the way that God made you. And her mother, she remembered for many years afterwards, gave her the first black doll that she had ever seen. And she said, sang a little snatch of a hymn, I wouldn't be a white man because I might go to hell. So early on, her mother tried to buttress her sense of self-importance and her sense of identity as a valuable child of God. Mother was an interesting person, by the way. She noticed that her mother carried three pails to work with her in the fields. And one of the pails she kept covered all the time. So being curious, she removed the cover one day and looked in, and there was a 9mm Luger in that bucket. Her mother was not a woman who was going to take anything from any white man.
What stance did her mother take in relation to the white landowner and the other whites who oversaw the work in the fields?
Well, one early incident that she remembered quite vividly was a white man came to the fields to look for one of the black children who was a cousin of Fannie Lou's, and he wanted to punish her for something she hadn't done. And the woman said, you're not taking any black children today, and if you want to fight about that, get off that horse, and I'll fight you all the way to hell and back. And the white man did not get off his horse. So this was the stance that her mother took. And in the Mississippi of those days, that was a very risky stance to take. But her mother was not going to put up with any violence against her children or the children of her relatives.
In 1951, and now we're skipping ahead quite a bit, this is after she married a man named Perry Hamer. In 1951, Fannie Lou Hamer went to the hospital to have a cyst removed from her stomach. What happened?
Without her permission or her knowledge, she became the subject of a hysterectomy, which was not unusual for black women in Mississippi. The attempt to control the population by unacknowledged and unwilling hysterectomies was, we don't know the statistics on it, but it was not unknown. It was relatively common.
So civil rights activists came to her county in Mississippi, held a mass meeting in August 1962. So let's see. Fannie Lou Hamer was about 45 years old. What impact did being at that meeting and seeing what the activists were doing and saying, what impact did that have on Hamer?
It had a major impact upon her. It might be seen as a kind of conversion experience. She knew the conditions in which she and her people lived, and she knew that the right to vote was prevented from black people by subterfuge and by outright violence. But when she heard one of the civil rights activists from SNCC, James Bevel, preaching, he preached on knowing the signs of the times. And she was struck by the power and the beauty of his sermon. And after the sermon was over, the civil rights workers, Bevel and several others, tried to get people to volunteer to challenge the non-voting laws and to go down to the county courthouse and to vote. And Fannie Lou Hamer was one of 18 people who pulled up enough gumption to sign that paper, promising that they would, on the very next Friday, go to the courthouse and try to register to vote, which they did. And needless to say, they were denied the possibility of voting. And by the time she got home, her boss on the plantation had already heard the news from the registrar. And he summarily fired her and fired her husband. So they had to leave the plantation that very night.
Now, at the courthouse, this is in Indianola, Mississippi, they were given a test, right? They were given a test that they, what, had to pass in order to then be eligible to vote?
Yes, this was a test on the Constitution of Mississippi. And Fannie Lou Hamer said she didn't even know that Mississippi had a constitution. And it was the kind of test developed so that no one, especially a black person who was uneducated, had any possibility of passing that test. It was so difficult that white people would have had difficulty passing it.
So some people might think that voting by African-Americans in states like Mississippi was prohibited, was banned by law. So how does that square with this idea, that this practice of giving a test to somebody coming in, and if they pass the test, they are eligible to vote?
Well, it's true. In practice, they were forbidden from voting, though they would not admit that publicly. That is, the Southern white structure, power structure, would not admit it publicly because it looked bad. So they would actually create ruses by which black people could not pass a test. And this was widespread throughout the South, not just in Mississippi. And the ruses included things like estimate how many pennies are in this jar. And, of course, they always failed. So while there was no announcement that blacks need not try to vote publicly made, it was well known by both blacks and whites throughout the South.
So as you said, her boss, and in fact the landowner, you know, the owner of the land where her family lived, fired her and her husband. They had to move. Where did they go?
She had to leave immediately because rumor was about that the Klan would be out that night. And indeed, their house was shot into 7 times. And another house was shot into where 2 black girls were wounded that night. So her husband, Pap, as she called him, told her to clear out and move to another county where she had a niece who would take care of her. So she left that night, and Pap stayed around, but he was unemployed, and no one would employ him because of he was Fannie Lou Hamer's husband.
That's the voice of Albert Robiteau. He is the Henry W. Putnam Professor of Religion Emeritus at Princeton University. And we're talking about his book, American Prophets, 7 Religious Radicals and Their Struggle for Social and Political Justice, recently out from Princeton University Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, Hamer, right, she's denied the right to vote. She's given this test, which she did not pass. She eventually did pass the voter registration test. Did that mean she could vote?
Yes, although the vote was practically useless because, of course, the Democratic Party, which was a majority party in Mississippi as well as throughout the South, was all white. So there were no black delegates until the black people of Mississippi, led by Hamer and several other black leaders, formed the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And for those of you who are old enough to remember the 1964 Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenged the credentials of the Mississippi State Democratic Party, which was all white, on the grounds that it didn't fully represent the voters. And this was taken up by the Credentials Committee. And Fannie Lou Hamer was interviewed giving a speech before the Credentials Committee on live television, in which she described the horrific beating that she experienced in Sunflower County, Mississippi, on her way back from a civil rights meeting that she had gone to with several other activists, black activists, on the Sea Islands with Ella Baker and several other civil rights leaders. And on their way back, they stopped at this town, which happened to be the headquarters of the White Citizens Council in Mississippi. And several of them went in to try to get served because the Public Accommodations Act had been passed by that time. They were refused service, and they were not only refused service, they were arrested. And they were severely beaten. Fannie Lou Hamer was beaten so badly that her kidneys were damaged, one of her eyes was damaged. And a friend of hers, a woman named Annelle Pounder, who was also active in the civil rights movement in Mississippi, was beaten beyond recognition. And Fannie Lou could hear her screams as she was being beaten. And she also heard her saying to the people who were beating her, the white sheriffs and deputies, they would ask her, "Can't you say sir?" And she would say, "Yes, I know, sir." And they would say, "Well, why aren't you saying it?" And she said, "Because I don't know you well enough." Now, that's an amazing act of audacity in those circumstances. And then she went on to say, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." So this is the kind of spiritual dimension that Fannie Lou Hamer and Annelle Pounder and others had. And Fannie Lou had an amazing singing voice, and she would sing this little light of mine, "I'm Gonna Let It Shine in Times of Danger," or the civil rights hymn, "Paul and Silas Bound in Jail, Ain't Got No One to Go My Bail." And through these songs, she and others would try to keep up their spirits, to keep up their courage, and also significantly to identify themselves with the early Christian martyrs suffering in the agoras of the ancient world, just as they were suffering in the jails of in the South of Mississippi in particular.
It's remarkable, isn't it? Somebody who's being beaten, perhaps nearly to death, who is saying, "Forgive the people who are beating me, for they know not what they do. Have mercy on them." There's a kind of compassion there, a sensitivity that would escape maybe the large majority of us at that moment.
Yes, and most recently, the example of the people whose relatives were killed in Charleston, South Carolina, at Emmanuel AME Church by Dylann Roof. Some of those families, you will recall, and your listeners will recall, actually forgave Dylann Roof for what he had done. And this is part of a long tradition within African-American religious history, the notion of imitating Jesus' act of forgiveness on the way to the cross, and using that as an example to raise the question, if Christ came as the suffering servant, who resembled him more, the slave or the master?
So in other words, Hamer was relating scriptural wisdom directly and specifically to the plight of African Americans in poor rural Mississippi.
Yes. That's exactly right. And Hamer claimed, when she would give speeches, as she did around the country, she would claim that, using the terms from Isaiah, which Jesus used about himself in one of the synagogues, "I am anointed by the Spirit of the Lord to preach liberty to the captives and salvation to those who are oppressed." So she assumed that mantle, as many black people did, going all the way back to slavery times.
And if you're being hated, if you're being abused and tortured and beaten, the natural thing, of course, is to hate back. Obviously, Fannie Lou Hamer didn't agree with that. Why didn't she feel that hate reciprocated would somehow solve or address the issue, the problem?
She felt that it would just simply be useless, and even more than useless, that hatred and bitterness would corrode her soul, would corrode the souls of those who were being abused. So abusing others or even hating others who hated you was simply to assume the illness that afflicted them. And that's why she refused to hate. And like Martin Luther King Jr. and many other of the figures who were active in the civil rights movement, there was a strong sense that redemptive suffering can be salvific, that somehow redemptive suffering can change not only your life, but it can change the life of the oppressor. Now, that takes a lot of faith, but these people lived it out in a day-to-day way. If I can be autobiographical just for a moment, my father was killed by a white man in Mississippi 3 months before I was born. The white man was never arraigned. He was not charged for that murder. Because of it, my mother, now a widow, moved to the north with me and my two older sisters. And she remarried in the north. And I grew up, and I grew up not hearing the story about my father's death. And when I was 16, about to start my freshman year in college in Los Angeles, my mother and my stepfather sat me down, and for the first time they told me the story of my father's death. And they said, "We never told you the story because we didn't want you to grow up hating white people."
Hmm. That's powerful. There's so much to say about Fannie Lou Hamer, and much more of what we can say this hour is in my guest Albert Robiteau's book, American Prophets, Seven Religious Radicals in Their Struggle for Social and Political Justice. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org, as well as to Al's homepage at Princeton University. His last name is spelled R-A-B-O-T-E-A-U. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So a lot to say about Fannie Lou Hamer. I mean, you know, she was the first black woman ever to run for Congress in Mississippi. She ran to represent the 2nd Congressional District of Mississippi. I want to move to the Black Voter Registration Projects that civil rights leaders planned for 1963 and 1964. The Freedom Vote Project took place in 1963, and the Freedom Summer Initiative happened in 1964. How did Fannie Lou Hamer, how did she think about what was happening? Obviously, there were a lot of non-blacks who were coming down from the north to participate in what was happening. There were trainings. They were very involved in what was going on in Mississippi and the South. What was Hamer's take on these initiatives?
Well, she was very much in favor of them, particularly the education part of it. Remember that it was not just voting rights, but it was literacy training as well, especially for black children in the South. And she actually went to one of the training sessions in the summers that were held in Ohio. And she sang and spoke about what the situation was like in the South. And she remembered always with great admiration the murder of the three civil rights workers, Cheney and Goodman and Swerner, who were killed by the sheriff's deputies in Mississippi during that Freedom Summer. And the fact that they would be martyrs for that cause was deeply moving to her. She had some objections to lack of sensitivity sometimes of some of the students who went south in Mississippi Freedom Summer. She warned them do not make fun of our religion. For example, some of these students were secular and thought that religion was the opiate of the people. She said, "Don't make fun of our religion because we take it very seriously." And she also cautioned the black women and black men to watch their associations with each other because of the tremendous obstacle to interracial relationships as a red flag for Southern racists. And she also cautioned them on being careful about being alone and driving cars at night in places that were far away from towns. So she had a realistic sense of what the situation was in the South and was concerned, particularly after the murder of the three civil rights workers, was concerned about the safety of these people. And she also looked at their involvement as a godsend. When she had to leave her home, as I mentioned earlier, and seek sanctuary with a niece who lived far away, Bob Moses sent a civil rights worker to contact her to take her to some civil rights classes at various colleges, black colleges in the South. And when he arrived, he asked her if she would come with him, and she said, sure. And she went back, and 2 or 3 minutes later, she was packed and ready to go. And he said, did you know that I was coming? And she said, yes, God told me that you were coming. And she said, well, it wasn't God who sent me. It was Bob Moses. And she said, but God sent Bob Moses. Look at his last name. So she was very aware of the practical advantages of the white and black civil rights workers coming down during the summer, but also aware of the dangers and of the limitations of what they could do, and very much aware that this was a situation that took a good deal of courage, but also took a good deal of sanity in terms of behavior.
Al, you referred earlier to the effort to disrupt and to challenge the goings-on at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey. So the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was established to challenge the Democratic Party in Mississippi, the regular Democratic Party in Mississippi, and its policy of excluding black members. And so then Fannie Lou Hamer goes to Atlantic City as part of a delegation to challenge the seating of the all-white regular Democratic Party at the DNC. What happened at the DNC? And you've of course referred to, you know, what she said about her beating in jail. But just in terms of the mechanics, what happened in terms of their effort to challenge the seating?
Well, Fannie Lou Hamer's speech was so powerful and so moving that the DNC was flooded with phone calls and telegrams in response to it. And when President Johnson saw this and heard about the response, he became concerned that he would lose the regular Mississippi Party, and he worried what effect this would have upon his reelection campaign. So he commissioned Vice President Hubert Humphrey and several other liberals to go and talk to the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and try to convince them to back off on their attempt to unseat the regular Democratic Party. When Humphrey confronted Fannie Lou Hamer, she astutely said, I know that you don't want to lose your job as vice president, but think of all of the people in Mississippi who would, like me, have lost their jobs by attempting to vote. And he said, don't worry about losing your job. I'm going to pray for you, Mr. Humphrey, and Jesus will protect you from losing your job. And Martin Luther King Jr. urged them to take a compromise where they would take 2 non-voting positions on the floor of the convention. A number of other black politicians encouraged them to compromise. And Fannie Lou Hamer and several other members of the Freedom Democratic Party said, we didn't come all this way for no 2 non-voting seats. And several members of the Credentials Committee actually gave them their passes to the convention floor. Meanwhile, the regular Mississippi Democratic Party had already bolted the convention. They couldn't agree with the platform anyway. And so there were about two of them left. And so the Freedom Party members, several of them, took the credentials that had been given to them and went to occupy the empty seats. But the sergeant at arms on the floor wouldn't allow them to take those seats. So it was pretty much a failure all the way around.
And what did Hamer's actions at the convention, the way she spoke to the media, the story she told, her refusal to accept offered compromises, what did that do in terms of bringing her to the national stage in terms of visibility, in terms of media coverage? And can you describe in any way her power of language, her eloquence, how effective she was at delivering a message?
Well, what happened as a result of the attention that was drawn to Fannie Lou Hamer and to the situation in the South was a sense that was actually prophesied in her own comments as she ended her testimony. She said, "Is this America? Is this the land of the free and the home of the brave?" And that challenge had such an effect upon many people who watched what went on at the convention, especially watched and listened to her testimony, that it created a tremendous amount of goodwill across the country. And so Fannie Lou Hamer began to receive invitations to speak in Wisconsin and Chicago and Berkeley, California, all across the country, particularly in terms of liberal circles. And she had a tremendously articulate way of speaking in which she used biblical verses, and she had a tremendous memory. So she would quote biblical verses, and then she would give not just the verse, but the chapter of the Bible that the verse came from and the verse number as well. And she would mobilize these verses with this powerful voice in a way that both humanized the scriptures and moved people to actually understand the power of her challenge. Is this America? Is this the land of the free and the home of the brave? That is, she enabled people to absorb that kind of moral challenge by the power of her rhetoric and by her use of scriptures. And not just the biblical scriptures, but the civil scripture of the nation. The notion that this is a land of the free, that this is a land of the brave. She challenged those scriptural senses of identity, those scripts, as it were, which have always been part of American identity, and said, if this is our identity, why is it not being lived out?
Albert Robiteau talking about his book, American Prophets, Seven Religious Radicals and Their Struggle for Social and Political Justice. We'll take a short break and speak more with Al about his book. We'll turn next to another important figure, one of the seven people he features and discusses and describes at length in his book, and that is Thomas Merton. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Albert Robiteau joins me. He is the Henry W. Putnam Professor of Religion Emeritus at Princeton University. His books include Slave Religion, the, quote, invisible institution in the antebellum South, A Fire in the Bones, Reflections on African-American Religious History, and Canaan Land, A Religious History of African-Americans. We are talking about his new book. It's called American Prophets, Seven Religious Radicals and Their Struggle for Social and Political Justice. Thomas Merton is one of these seven prophets that you discuss in this book. He was born in France in 1915. He converted to Catholicism in 1938. He moved around a lot, I should say. As a child, he lost both parents. They died when, I think his mother died when he was six and his father died when he was 15. You write that in his earlier works, Thomas Merton espoused a world-rejecting attitude. A world-rejecting attitude, meaning what?
Meaning that he felt that the Christian identity, particularly his Christian identity, needed to reject the blandishments, as it were, of modern society, particularly consumerism, particularly the vices of the modern world, especially the vices of militarism and racism, and that one's true identity needed to be found in a life of prayer and of silence and to some extent of solitude, that was the way to get in touch with the real self, the self within. So Merton eventually entered a monastery because of this feeling of contempt to some extent for the distractions, as it were, of the world. You have to remember that he grew up in the period after the First World War and then was old enough to see the coming of the Second World War. And he lived a bohemian kind of life, both when he was an undergraduate student at Columbia in New York, and also when he had been a student in Cambridge. And there's a longstanding rumor that he probably fathered an illegitimate child when he was at Cambridge and had to leave England. His guardian dismissed him and sent him over to England to his American relatives because of the scandal. So there was this dimension of disorder within Merton's own life that helps to flesh out what it was he was talking about in terms of leaving the world. So eventually he had to make a decision about what he was going to do. He had found a teaching job after he earned his master's at Columbia at St. Bonaventure's University in upstate New York. And while he was there, he made a retreat at Gethsemane Abbey in Kentucky, not too far from Louisville, and was very attracted by the abbey. He also heard a woman speak when he was at St. Bonaventure's, whose name was Catherine de Hook Doherty, and she founded a group called Friendship House, somewhat similar to Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker Movement. Friendship House had several places where it worked, and one of them was in Harlem. So after Merton heard her speak, he talked with her, and she challenged him to come to Harlem and to work in Friendship House. And so he did, and he was impressed by the work that was being done there, depressed by the poverty that he saw. But he also sensed that in this poverty was a place of holiness. So Merton, at this stage, felt drawn by two attractions. One was, do I become a monk at Gethsemane, which is clearly a place of great holiness, or do I become a social worker in Harlem, which also has the possibility of being a place of holiness, to live among the poor and the despised? And eventually, He had a mystical experience. He was walking on campus at St. Bonaventure's one night, and he heard bells ringing, and he recognized them as the bells from the Abbey of Our Lady of Gethsemane in Kentucky, and that convinced him to go to the monastery. So he joined the monastery and became a monk there.
And he had, in addition to this mystical experience, perhaps this is earlier in his life, in one of his journals, Thomas Merton points to a kind of epiphany he had about people around him and what he felt. Describe what happened.
This actually was later in his life. It was after he had entered the monastery, and he had gone into Louisville for a doctor's appointment. He had bursitis badly, and he went to see a surgeon about it. And he was standing on a street corner in Louisville, the corner of 4th and Walnut. Walnut is now Muhammad Ali Avenue. And he's looking at the people as they're passing him, and he has this sense of love for all these people, he says, as they walk past. And he can see within them this point of light. He calls it le point vierge, this virginal point, which is inaccessible to the fantasies of our minds and the brutalities of our will. It's that place within each person where God's being meets our being. And if we could just all of us see that being, we would see that people are walking around with this blaze of light within them, and that light is bright enough to light a million suns if we could just see it. And he says, I have no way of guaranteeing that seeing. All I know is that the gate of heaven is everywhere. So this was a major experience, and he goes on from that experience to talk about how he felt that there was something spurious about his vocation, in the sense that even as a monk, it was ridiculous for him to think that he could leave humankind, that he was human just like everyone else. And he didn't question his monastic vows or his monastic life, but it was spurious to think that this was somehow some kind of sacred life that was above and beyond the normal life of every human being. So this was a major conversion experience for Merton, to return himself to a deep and rich sense of what human life is about, the hidden wholeness that binds all people together in terms of this point vierge that lies in at our center.
Well, that's the voice of Albert Robiteau. He is a professor of religion emeritus at Princeton, and his new book is American Prophets, Seven Religious Radicals and Their Struggle for Social and Political Justice. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Did he think that the contemplative person could speak out on political matters, or was it stronger than that? Did he feel like somebody engaged in contemplation had a duty or an obligation to make statements about racial or social injustice?
He felt that the contemplative would be in a position, because of his physical separation from the world, to perhaps have a perspective on the ills of our society, the giant triplets of excess materialism, of militarism, of racism, and that he might have a perspective that could speak effectively to critiquing these giant triplets. And in a sense, Merton is reuniting himself now that he is a contemplative monk, indeed is living a hermit life in a hermitage about a quarter of a mile from the monastery. He is returning to social interests that he had as a young man. But he's returning to it now with the perspective, the deeper perspective of a mature man, honed by his contemplative experience. So suddenly Merton begins to write about race. He begins to write about nuclear armament. He begins to write about consumerism. And some of his readers who were used to the Thomas Merton of Thoughts and Solitude and The Silent Life and spiritual books are wondering what's gotten into Merton? Why is he writing all of this social criticism? And what's happened is that he's now gotten to a new level of understanding about the relationship between the individual self and the social self. And so he begins to turn out essays on these social ills that are very perceptive. And he produces one famous tract called Letters to a White Liberal, which is published in a book called Confessions of a Guilty Bystander, which is a great title. And Martin Marty, who is a historian of Christianity at the University of Chicago, wrote a scathing critique of this book and said that Merton seems to think he's the white James Baldwin hiding behind monastery walls. So this kind of criticism that Merton's making is certainly disappointing to some who would, knew him as a spiritual writer. But come the hot summer of 67, there is in the National Catholic Reporter a public letter written by Martin Marty in which he says that, you know, I recant what I said about Merton. Merton is telling me like it is and like it will be. That is, Merton had predicted that white liberals did not really understand the cost that would be required by the civil rights movement, that they also did not understand and foresee the violence that would result from the Black Power movement and from the ongoing difficulties that Black people faced in this country. And without seeing the full cost, they were actually blunting the power of the movement of Black people towards taking control of their own lives and their own societies.
And how were they doing that in Merton's view? What were white liberals doing, perhaps in addition to not recognizing the costs, as you were saying? What were they doing with their actions or perhaps their inaction to present obstacles to Black liberation?
What Merton saw was that, for example, the March on Washington, which was seen as kind of a high point of concern and change over the civil rights movement, had been taken over by whites, and that the effect of it, and this is true, the effect of it blunted the radical criticism from SNCC and other members of the Black political movement who wanted to speak much more aggressively than King did about the ills of the society. Secondly, while he was happy about the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, he was aware that those were going to have their effect certainly in the South. But what effect were they going to have upon racism in the North? What effect were they going to have on housing integration, for example? What effect were they going to have in places of extreme poverty, as in Chicago, and the kind of mob actions that the attempt to integrate in East Chicago had, West Chicago, I'm sorry, in terms of marches that were led by King there. So for Merton, he says integration is great as long as it's in the South, you know, but what about if Black people want to move in next to you in the North? You will sell him, and this is a literal quote, you will sell him down the river for the 100th time. So he had a very astute notion of what the cost would actually be if the nation were going to be serious about civil rights, not just as a Southern problem, but as a national problem. He also read Malcolm X's autobiography, and he appreciated the perceptiveness of Malcolm X's critique, and he could see why the Nation of Islam would appeal to Black people, because it gave them a sense of control. So here's a man who's cloistered in a monastery but has this amazing sense of, you know, the difficulties of civil rights, difficulties, do I dare say, that we still have in civil rights in this country.
Thomas Merton placed a lot of emphasis on alienation, on the alienation we experience and that he thought was endemic to U.S. society. What's the nature of that alienation in his eyes?
The nature of it is a fear of facing our own mortality and hiding from that mortality. And by mortality, not just death, but mortality in the sense of our being prey to, psychological difficulties, to disappointments, to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, if I can quote Shakespeare. And that one of the ways in which we try to avoid that is through consumerism. We are powerful in the sense that we don't have any need that we can't buy something to satisfy that need. And so we fall into this trap of need, satisfaction or gratification, and then more need and more gratification. So we become, as he puts it, suckers on this this inexhaustible roller coaster of need and satisfaction that get us nowhere but alienate us from our true selves. And what we really need is to seek the solitude, the silence, to be able to encounter our real self with all of its fallibility and with all of its fragility, and not to try to escape it by false means, whether those be alcohol or consumerism of various sorts.
And I'm just reading briefly from my guest Albert Robitaille's book, American Prophets. Like Dr. King, Thomas Merton believed that beyond barriers of race, nationality, and religion, we must identify ourselves with the poor, the oppressed, and the wretched of the earth. It is our calling to become the voice of the voiceless, the face of the faceless, to an unheeding and uncaring society. We've just got a couple minutes left, Al. Tell us who else you feature and profile in this book, American Prophets.
The seven prophets are first Abraham Joshua Heschel, who was prominently involved as a rabbi in the civil rights movement, marched prominently with King and Selma, and who had a wonderful definition of the prophet as one who experiences as a fire in the bones God's compassion, God's pathos for humanity. A.J. Mustie, who was head of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the most prominent pacifist in on the American scene in the 20th century. Dorothy Day, who with co-workers was the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, which attempted not just to help the poor by writing checks, but actually to live among the poor and to see in the poor the distressing disguise of Christ, as her friend Mother Teresa put it. Howard Thurman, who was a college chaplain and also an ecumenist, who was a tremendous theoretician in terms of the need for us to perceive the commonality that we all share, the common ground, and that indeed it is part of the being of human beings and of all being to search for commonality from the simplest cell to the most complex society. And then Thomas Merton, I have already spoken about, and Martin Luther King Jr. and Fannie Lou Hamer I have spoken about as well.
A lot to read, a lot to absorb in this book, American Prophets, Seven Religious Radicals and Their Struggle for Social and Political Justice, written by my guest Albert Robitaille, spelled again R-A-B-O-T-E-A-U. He is Henry W. Putnam Professor of Religion Emeritus at Princeton University. We have links to his book and to his faculty page at Princeton on our website, againstthegrain.org. Al, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. This is, Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and much more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.